And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Turns out we're still popeless. Yes, still popeless. Haven't seen the puff of smoke yet. But we're still counting the days until we're popeful. I wonder how long we're going to use those, because we're popeless, or we're being popeful. We'll see what happens. Also, the furloughs are coming. Welcome to the era of the time-released austerity bomb. Over the next month, we're going to start seeing federal agencies scaling back. You're going to see longer lines. You're going to see less service. But that is what the Republicans want to bring us. Also, later in the program, more fun with guns seems every day. There's an amusing story on the gun front and also a few deadly ones. As I got last night, about 10:30 in the Harrisburg area, murder number 4. So that, you know, to use the frame that the right wingers love to use, there are more people killed with hammers. Not necessarily the truth. Here in Harrisburg, 3 people killed with a gun, 1 with a hammer. So you got a 3-to-1 ratio right here in the backyard. Also, the deadly sinkhole over the weekend. We're going to talk about funding of transportation and infrastructure with our good friend Abe Amoros, and also real death panels and more on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which is working its way through the pipe as we speak. Also, your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the program, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Big news today. Big news. Yesterday, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said that, quote, now that we are having to reduce or eliminate basically overtime both for TSA and for customs, now that we have instituted a hiring freeze, we will begin today sending out furlough notices. She said, we are already seeing the effects. 150 to 200% the lines at the TSA counters are now than they would normally be expected. She said, if you are traveling by air, you're going to have to start getting to the airport earlier. So instead of 2 hours early, now it's going to be, who knows? And she says, if you're trying to make a connecting flight, you're going to have to make your arrangements to give you greater time to deal with it. And you look at the number of Federal Aviation Administration employees that are going to see some time in the street, 15,000 air traffic controllers. They're going to be forced into an unpaid situation, more furloughs there. So, you know, hey, the austerity thing, working. And as I've been saying for the longest time, this is really good for the Republicans because it's already got people ticked off. I mean, we're only a day and a half, 2 days into it. And people are already upset. So what do we do? Well, I like what the TSA administrator, John Pistol, came out with today. Just kind of makes me scratch my head and go, I feel safer already. Evidently, starting on April 25th, if you are flying on a U.S. flight, you're going to be able to carry a small pocket knife with you. Less than 6 centimeters. That's about 2.5 inches, right? You'll be able to carry with you 2 of your favorite golf clubs. No more than 2. Just, you know, 1 or 2 golf clubs, that's it. Ski poles, because, you know, I don't know when the last time I was sitting in a plane going, gee, I sure feel naked without my ski poles. Also, you can maybe bring a hockey stick or a cross stick, some, you know, a billiard pool stick, you know, something like that. Baseball bat's still on the no-fly list. Can't take a full-size baseball bat, but you can get a wiffle bat. And one of those, you know, those souvenir bats that they give you at the ballpark, less than 24 inches? Yeah, right there. Will I still have to take my shoes off? And do I still have to take the belt off? Because now if we're saying, okay, you know, go ahead. You know, we're going to let you carry on a pocket knife. Because if I remember right, you know, the whole box cutter thing, box cutters are kind of small. 2.5 inch blade, so I have to take the shoes off. That's one of my big concerns. Now look, I get it. You know, we're not going to see another September 11th with people hijacking with box cutters again. But still, And, you know, you look at these things and you go, how long did it take TSA to come up with? You could bring a souvenir bat or a wiffle ball bat. Now, the guy who's the spokesman for the agency said that, you know, well, these are popular items that we see regularly. And, you know, they don't, present a risk to you know, our transportation security. No, no risk at all. And I'm going, you know, I don't know. I've flown a couple of times. I've never seen anyone walking around with their souvenir wiffle bat. I just haven't. Or a lacrosse stick, for that matter. Or a hockey stick. Or ski poles. I don't think I've ever seen anybody want to get on the plane. Will that fit in the overhead compartment? I don't think so. Anyway, so there you go. Good news on that front. Also good news, the Dow Jones Industrial, highest point since the Great Depression. Socialism must be working really well. Wall Street must really love socialism. Because if you listen to the righties tell the story, Obama has led us into the world of socialism. They're taking over. Those where the free enterprise system is dead. Except on Wall Street, where the Dow Jones has reached the highest point since the Great Depression. But, you know, again, you know, the facts be damned. And we've gone through this a number of times. You're seeing Wall Street doing very, very well. Everybody else, screw you. Starve. Because we need to give more tax breaks to those people on Wall Street. You know, the people who are making money. Not you. No, no, no. Don't care about you. What we could do for you is gambling. More gambling. And I look at the story I just saw before we came on the air that the slot revenue here in the state of Pennsylvania, in the tank, last month was down 9.2%. Third consecutive month of declines. And they go, well, you know, it's the effect of competition. Basically what I've been saying about all of this beating each other up stuff, the whole beggar thy neighbor economic development, the whole, hey, if we lower our tax rate, we'll be able to steal work from them over there. And if we have porous labor laws and if we allow the exploitation of our workers, we'll get jobs. You know, the whole argument that they make for this nonsensical right to work nonsense, especially in Indiana. Well, if we pass it, we'll be able to steal jobs from Illinois. And it's all this race to the bottom. And even the people who are the heads of the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board, which, look, you know, it's 3 months in a row, it's lost money. Privatize it. Because we need people pushing gambling. And if you look at if you take this Valley Forge Casino Resort out, the latest, greatest, newest, bestest, fantastic, you know, casino that opened last March, if you take that out of the equation, that 9.2 actually goes up to 11.5 for the other 10 casinos. We've got 11 casinos in the Commonwealth, which makes us the second largest gambling market in the country behind Las Vegas. And it's one of those things you go, wow, that's pretty impressive. Look at us. Look at us funding. What are we funding with gambling money again? Oh, yeah. Rebates for seniors. Because we believe in we want to take care of our seniors. Well, guess what? It's declining. And, you know, and again, they point out it's the competition. You know, as Maryland comes online, New York, Ohio, Delaware, all of these states are competing to try and get that gambling dollar. And they'll basically steal it all from Atlantic City, which is what we were doing. So beggar thy neighbor doesn't quite work. My favorite part of the article on the gambling, though, came from a quote by the folks at the Pennsylvania Equine Coalition. They represent about 10,000 owners and trainers. You know, the horse racing industry. You know the owners and the people who own the horses and the jockeys and all that stuff. They're upset. Casino profits down, and they say that the reason that the horse racing side of it is declining is because evidently there was some money taken away from this fund, this horse racing development fund, which I guess was just a slush fund for the owners and the trainers, but took that away. And now it's about losing money. And we need to lobby for it. We need to get it back. And this year is supposed to be the year for lobbyists. K Street has had a couple of years slide in a row. This was supposed to be the bounce back year. And I look at the super huge lobbying firm, Patton Boggs, who I guess last week just fired 65 people, 23 in Detroit. Or in D.C., they're the big boys of the industry because their revenue dropped by $2 million, down to $46 million last year. Now, understand, Patton Boggs, they recorded well, a pretty sizable $317 million revenue last year. So that $2 million drop in the bucket. But K-Street's been kind of on the slide. The last couple of years, you've seen it go down a little. 2010, you had the high year of $3.55 billion spent on lobbying. 2011, K-Street reported $3.33 billion. And 2012, another slide to $3.28 billion. And they were hoping that the big money would come back because there's some divisive issues on the horizon. You know, you got to get those billionaires digging. And I was thinking about this. I'm going, you know, $3.5 billion on a $15 trillion economy? That's really not an awful lot of money. But, you know, you divvy that up amongst the, what, more than, like, there's almost 13,000 lobbyists in D.C. right now. That's a ton of money. And for what? Well, to get their little slice of the pie. And if you remember, the last election, Ben Nelson, the Democrat from Nebraska, he decided, well, I'm not running for re-election. It's time to go cha-ching. He has found a new lobbying firm. He and a couple of his former associates, I think the one was the his chief of staff while he was in the Senate, they have formed the Heartland Strategy Group. They are a government and public affairs firm. Yeah, they're going to do the, they're going to cash in on the connections, cash in on the being the moderate centrist, formerly known as the Republican Party Democrat. So he's going to be doing some of that. Just going to serve in an advisory role, so he'll make a nice chunk of that because he had already joined the public affairs firm Agenda as their senior advisor and a chief executive of the insurance commissioner group. And he's going to pocket about $1 million a year just in that one gig. So you stop and think about it. Here was a guy making $174,000 a year as a senator, not pocketing well over $1 million cashing in. And this is why I've been saying for the longest time, we need to slam that swinging door shut. I'm not against somebody making a living, but I got to tell you, going from a job making $174,000 a year as a senator into those $1 million gigs, something seriously wrong. And what ends up happening? Well, they use those contacts to stick it to you and me. And, you know, it's just absolutely mind-blowing in my view, the money that is wasted there. You know what we should be doing with that money? We should be taking that money and we should be investing it in schools. We should be taking it, investing it in productive activities like research and development and get our manufacturing base back instead of having a bunch of slick lawyers doing a whole bunch of maneuvering to make sure the handful of special interests who are funding them are well taken care of. Because you know what ends up happening? It's you and me and other working people who end up holding the bag and getting the shaft. And it just is what it is. And until we say no more, it's going to continue. And I am, for one, just fed up with it. All of this money that you see just pouring into these campaigns and this lobbying effort, just, you know, as I said, you know, when I was working, I was a member of a labor union. I had a lobbyist. I didn't have a team of them. I had one. And I think about that quite often. How many working people have people fighting for them in Congress or here in Harrisburg? Not nearly enough. I'll take a quick break. Right back after this. Going to talk about the sequestration and what it's doing to folks across the country. Quick break. Right back. And take your money. All they want to do is add up. And take your money. All they want to do is add up. And take your money. All they want to do is add up. And take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In the first week of the sequester budget cuts aimed at reducing the federal deficit, United Steelworkers President Leo Girard says the political debate and the struggle over deficit reduction is the wrong fight to be having.
The biggest deficit we have in this country is a deficit on jobs. And we also believe we're having the wrong fight. The fight that we're having shouldn't be about deficit reduction. It should be about rebuilding the infrastructure of America and putting people back to work. And that will solve the deficit in the long term.
Girard says America also needs a high road economic strategy to sustain the American standard of living.
You can't sustain a consumer society on falling and declining standard of living and declining wages. So we've called for a high wage strategy similar to what they're doing in Europe and Scandinavian countries, who, by the way, got an unemployment rate now down in the 5.5% rate. If we had a 5.5% rate of unemployment, we'd have no deficit issue.
The United Auto Workers say that Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's state takeover of the city of Detroit's finances is, quote, further evidence of his intent to erode democracy for the citizens of Michigan in general and the city of Detroit in particular, end quote. Snyder said March 1st he would appoint an emergency financial manager for Detroit. The UAW says dictating from the state capitol isn't the right formula to turn Detroit around. The state's emergency financial manager has the power to override the elected city government, to throw out existing labor contracts, change pension agreements, and sell off public assets, among other powers. Voters in Michigan repealed the financial emergency manager law in November, but Republicans controlling state government passed a new version of essentially the same law that voters had repealed. In 2014, employers will start offering health benefits to workers due to a requirement under the Affordable Care Act. But the question is, will workers buy into it? Jesse Russell looks at a new study.
ADP Research Institute has looked into the question of whether or not workers will buy into health benefits offered by employers and found mixed results, which mostly broke down by income levels. Perhaps not surprisingly, workers who earn more were more likely to opt in. ADP found that only 37% of workers in the $15,000 to $20,000 annual income range said that they were likely to buy into offered health benefits. However, that number jumped once the $20,000 threshold was reached, with 58% of those in the $20,000 to $25,000 income range saying they'd likely participate. Under the Act, employers who have more than 50 full-time employees are required to provide benefits to workers at a rate of 9.5% less than income. If employees opt out of buying insurance, there will be a penalty of either $95 or 1% of income starting in 2014. That penalty will increase substantially in the following years, reaching $695 or 2.5% of income in 2016. The study also found that the bigger cut of a paycheck a premium takes out, the less likely the employee is to stay on health care. The dropping out tends to occur once a premium starts taking up more than 3% of income.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job Killing Organization of America.
Because, brothers, it's fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some
blue. I gotta tell you, I miss that crazy woman. It was the whole Republican primary was just amazing to me. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs running around trying to out-crazy each other. That was just brilliant. I mean, that was a comedy show in and of itself. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Our quote of the day from Steny Hoyer. He says, a shutdown is stupid policy, but the sequester is super stupid policy. We're doing stupid things here. He says, I don't think shutting down government is good, but I don't think the alternative of doing it every 30 or 60 or 90 days is good either. And I go back to, you know, the Eisenhower quote and anyone who would come out against Social Security or unemployment or labor laws or the farm bill, the numbers are negligible and they're stupid. And unfortunately, there's stupid running one of our political parties, and probably half of the other one as well. But you look at the sequester, and what's it doing to people across the country? What's it doing to our economy? How many jobs is it hurting? That's why I've asked John O'Grady, president of the EPA local in Chicago, AFGE Local 704. He's also the treasurer of the Council of EPA Locals, Council 238, AFGE. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I look at these cuts, while extraordinarily wrong-headed and ideological, what's it going to do to our ability to make sure that the food we eat is safe and the air we breathe is safe?
Well, it's definitely going to impact it. It's not going to be some dramatic thing the day after people start taking furloughs, but it's certainly going to impact the agency. In terms of the people, the morale, I'm sure that some of the people that are close to retirement are just going to say, I've had enough, which is probably what the other party wants.
Right.
And a lot of our younger employees are going to look at the way Congress and this administration, to some extent, has been treating them and say, hey, when the economy picks up, I'm going to find a better place to work.
And that's really a grave concern I have, this brain drain, because, you know, in regulatory agencies, you need people who, you know, they have experience, they have the knowledge, they know what's going on. I think back to some of the mine safety folks who, you know, they're so badly understaffed and so badly undertrained and could never inspect all of the mines and, you know, things that get passed and the safety problems that come out of this. That worries me on so many levels.
Well, I agree. And, you know, I have to say that 99% of our folks, probably close to 100% of our folks, are at the Environmental Protection Agency because they believe in the mission of protecting human health and the environment. And I would say that in general for all federal employees. We're at the VA because we believe in helping veterans coming back from wars. And we're at the Food and Drug Administration to ensure that the nation's food supply is safe. It goes on and on. Doesn't matter what agency, what department. We're dedicated. And we're there for a reason. Going back to the Pendleton Act of 1883, there was a lot of cronyism and patronage in the federal government. The Pendleton Act was designed to ensure that there was a professional cadre of employees working at government. Regardless of who was in office, we did the job for the American people, for the American taxpayer. And that's what we're dedicated to doing.
Yeah, and you bring that up, the patronage, and a lot of folks don't, you know, I didn't live through the time when that was commonplace. Unfortunately, I didn't, but you read about those times, and whenever a new political party came in, everybody was out, and they replaced them with a whole bunch of new people who couldn't even find the bathroom, let alone do the job that they were supposed to do. And the taxpayer, the citizens, well, they got the shaft.
Well, that's right, and I see some similarities to today where, and I'll just be quite frank, it's the Republican Party predominantly that they're going after unions in general and certainly now the unions in the federal sector. And they want to destroy us. They want to destroy the good things we do for our people, the dedicated federal employees. And I believe that they want to go back to almost a right to work for less concept in the U.S. government.
Yeah, I'm with you. And the idea is that they want to have, and this is what gets me, they want to have people who are supposed to be the overseers, the regulators, they want to hold them in the same vein that they hold, that the private sector is able to hold all at-will employees, where if they don't like a decision they're made, they're out the door, that's it. And you'll get people who won't make decisions then.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, one of the reasons why you want a federal agency or department overseeing programs, such as the EPA overseeing environmental programs, is because it's so easy for the plant manager in a state to call up the governor's office and say, hey, get these guys off my back. Yet we can go in there and do a federal enforcement action and ensure that standards are the same between state, from state to state. And that ensures that states don't just travel around trying to find the most lenient state to do business in.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with John O'Grady, president of the EPA local in Chicago, local 704 AFGE. Also, he's the treasurer of their council of EPA locals, council 238. You know, in Chicago, what is the work of the EPA, your members? What do you guys do there?
Well, we span the gap of Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, cleaning up hazardous waste sites, assisting tribal authorities, assisting the states. We have six states in Region 5, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin. And we assist the state governments. We provide on-scene coordinators when that train gets derailed or that truck containing hazardous chemicals spills. We're out there protecting the public.
You're the people running towards the mess as I'm running away from it.
Exactly.
Because, you know, you hear a lot of rhetoric in the media, you hear, especially from politicians, well, government workers, they're just lazy, we could easily privatize those jobs. And, you know, I look at a lot of this stuff, and the more you talk to people who work in government, you go, I don't know about that.
You won't find that kind of dedication in the private sector that you have in the federal sector. And we take it very serious. We have taken a vow, an oath of office, that we will defend and protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we take that serious, and we carry that out through our work. Private sector doesn't. Now, I think one of the things that's going on here is twofold. One, you can bring in contractors, and guess what? Contractors have PACs, political action committees, that could contribute to these politicians.
You can't.
We cannot. It's a voluntary contribution, for example, through our union, but it's not anywhere near the level that these contractors can achieve. Second thing is, we're there to do the job. Contractors are there to make a profit. And you can't do the same high-quality work that we do and do it for less and still make a profit. It does not make sense.
So let's talk about the jobs that you guys rush towards as everyone else is running away. These sequester cuts, are as I look at it, are going to make you doing your job that much more difficult.
It's going to make it very difficult. In fact, the agency themselves, in response to Senator Barbara Mikulski, sent a letter on February 6th and outlined some of the things that are going to be potential impacts from sequestration. Anything from the Energy Star program, state air monitors, enforcement and compliance programs in all different medias, Superfund enforcement, so the hazardous waste site, tribal programs, because basically on tribal lands, they also have to mimic our laws, and we assist them with expertise, we assist them with funds. You name the program, it's going to be impacted. Now, here's one interesting way that the other side tends to try to get at the agency. They cut our travel funds, and if we don't have travel funds to go out and do the inspections, we can't collect data. If we don't have data, we can't enforce. If you can't enforce, you don't have an agency.
Well, that mission accomplished.
Pull out the
big banner, get the sock for the shorts, and have the parade.
You know, now, the other thing you were mentioning about our wonderful friend Michelle Bachmann and how she was talking about the agency, the job-killing agency, and my response to that is simple. If we were the job-killing agency, the economy should have gone in the toilet back in the 1970s.
Yep.
It didn't. It's a neutral economic impact. In other words, we have created this incredible industry in the United States about environmental consulting, environmental pollution control equipment that is exported worldwide. And, yes, some of the older, dirty plants have to be taken offline. But as they are taken offline, newer plants come online that can meet the environmental standards. And we're talking about our children and our grandchildren. And each succeeding generation,
yep.
Will they have clean air? Will they have clean water?
I grew up in the what I say is the home of the Clean Water and Air Act, Cleveland, Ohio, where you had the lake that was, when I was a kid, was dead. We were not allowed to swim anywhere near Lake Erie because it was everything. There was no life in it whatsoever. And I remember the acid rain. I remember the asthma problems I had as a kid. And, you know, I don't want my kids to have to live through that. And if it's going to cost a little bit more to make sure that we have reasonable air to breathe and water to drink, I'm sorry. I'm losing that whole job-killing agency thing.
Right. It's a myth. It's a myth of the other party. And actually, there's a number of companies and associations that want to have a level playing field across the United States, and they want to have the Environmental Protection Agency ensuring that they have that level playing field.
So let me ask you this. Your employees, the people that you represent, you yourself, these cuts, what's it going to mean to the average regulator, the average person on the line, the average government employee? I saw a furlough notice go out. Tell me about it.
Well, the furlough notice went out, and we're facing up to 13 days off without pay. And
how long is that over a month, six months?
It's actually over between April and September, so over a period of about 6 months. And it represents a substantial amount of pay that we're going to lose. And
that's on top of the pay freezes you've had for the last couple of years. And wasn't there a pay cut in there as well?
There wasn't a pay cut yet, but don't give them that idea.
Right.
We've actually had a pay freeze for 3 years, and it's we're probably not looking at anything until January of 2014, if we get anything then. And as you know, gas is going up, food's going up, food is tied to the transportation cost, which is tied to the fuel cost. I haven't had one bill in my household go down.
No, except your paycheck. I mean, the reality is a pay freeze for 3 years is a pay cut.
Absolutely. And the impact in our folks is that despite what people are saying that we're overpaid and all that sort of thing, we're not overpaid. We have a lot of people living from paycheck to paycheck. They're trying to raise their families. They're trying to pay for the things that they have to pay for their families, ensure that they pay their mortgages. And there's some grave concern by folks. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some increase in mortgage defaults or people having to figure out a way to keep the bank at the door and from coming crashing in on them. There's folks wondering how they're going to pay the college tuition for their kids. As we all know, yep, college tuitions have not gone up with inflation. They've gone up exceedingly fast, and what kids are paying now to go to college is just...
It's obscene.
It is. It's obscene.
And
you're
the thing that bothers me is, you know, you hear the people saying, well, we need to help the economy, we need to grow the economy, yet they think a good idea is pulling a huge chunk of money out of the economy, and somehow the confidence fairy is going to come and expand our economy when we're actually working to contract it.
Well, it's the same thinking that's created the trickle-down theory or the tax cut theory of the Bush administration. You know, I'm still waiting for those all those jobs that were created by the Bush tax cuts.
They were created, though, John. They were created in places like China and India.
Yes, exactly.
They weren't. Because you look at these insane trade deals we've got destroying this country and the American middle class. Let me ask you a last question I've got for you. As we look at these massive cuts, and, you know, the right frame this, I think, the best way they could have. It's a very small amount. It's only 3%. Yeah, you know, you could do it if you really wanted to, John. You just wouldn't. You'd buy the store brand mac and cheese instead of the brand kind. And really minimized it so that people go, well, you know, it's only 3%. What does 3% mean to your agency, and what should we be? Who should be screaming about this?
Well, the American people should be screaming about this. The citizens and the taxpayers and the voters. And let me put it into perspective. 1% of all Americans, they say, are millionaires. 50% or over 50% of Congress are millionaires. So we have a bunch of rich people making decisions where they probably don't even know the price of milk,
yeah,
or the price of the generic mac and cheese.
That's an excellent point. We should be screaming at them early and often. John O'Grady, I appreciate the time, and I appreciate the work you folks do.
Thank you, sir, and thanks for having us on.
Thanks so much. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Here's a diabolical idea from the hottest level of hell, down where Wall Street's fiendish schemers and scammers dwell. Conspiring with state lawmakers, such powerhouse banks as J.P. Morgan Chase, U.S. Bank Corp., and Bank of America have devised a new way to enrich themselves by, get ready to gag, ripping off unemployed Americans. As Lily Tomlin has said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. These bankers have slithered into the process that states use to pay monthly jobless benefits to hard-hit people. These payments used to be mailed to recipients or deposited directly into their bank accounts. But Wall Street lobbyists, using phrases like win-win, have enticed states to switch the payment system to bank-issued debit cards. This saves states the cost of mailing or direct depositing the money, but banks don't do anything for free. Someone must pay for distributing the benefits to individuals. Guess who? Yes, the unemployed. Now, each month, the cost of distribution plus a generous profit for the bank are automatically deducted from the meager benefits the jobless receive. Then the bank hits them with ATM fees and other charges for using the card. How handy! In the sense that it puts bankers' hands right into the pockets of unemployed people, forcing those in dire need to pay millions of dollars in unnecessary fees to some of the richest bankers in the land. This is Jim Hightower saying, California, Indiana, Kansas, Maryland, and Nevada don't even allow recipients the choice of direct deposit, forcing them into the clutches of a particular bank, which violates federal law. But the whole system of profiteering on jobless people is an obscene violation of America's fundamental sense of morality. For information and action, go to National Consumer Law Center at nclc.org. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So this morning, you had Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack testifying before the House Committee on Agriculture, talking about what the sequester is going to do to food safety inspections. And, you know, since the sequester, the funding for animal and plant health inspection services going to be cut by $56 million. The food safety people are going to be cut $53 million. Another $2 million going to be gutted out of the grain inspection, packers, and stockyard administration. And so Vilsack's testifying. He says, look, no matter how you slice it and dice it, there's nothing you can do without impacting frontline inspectors. He said the inspectors are very, very important, and we will need to do everything we can to minimize the disruption. But he said, I have to be truthful to this committee that based on the way the sequester is structured, it will impact food inspection. So you have the guy who's the chair of the House Committee on Agriculture, a guy named Frank Lucas, a Republican from Oklahoma, who says, but you will, Mr. Secretary, utilize the maximum flexibility you have. You have substantial inspectors and plants all over the country, plants that work on different hour schedules. He said the odds that we would furlough every inspector on the same day are rather minuscule, correct? And it's true. You're not going to get all of them, but you're going to cut the number of them that are there, which, again, is part of the whole Republican way of doing things. And, you know, you look at the food safety in this country, 48 million people get sick every year. 128,000 people are hospitalized every year from foodborne illnesses, and 3,000 people die. You compare that to Europe, where they have 45,000 people who get sick instead of 48 million. They have 32,000 people who die from contamination, where we have 3,000. And you look at this and go, well, why is that? Well, because they actually fund their inspections. They actually make sure that, oh, I don't know, it's safe. And while they're following the austerity and they're doing what we're telling them to do, cut, they haven't done it as fast. I'll be honest. As the austerity continues, I'll bet you those numbers rise. But, you know, you look at the money that we're cutting out of the budget, and it's just ignorant to me. You know, on the healthcare front, you think about the funding cuts to infants and children, $20 million. You think of $168 million from substance abuse and mental health services. What's that gonna do? $75 million cut from aging and disability services. oh, yeah, no big deal. What about the almost $200 million that we're cutting in public housing? Ah, screw those people. Cardboard box for them all. And Granny, be happy that we're getting towards summer, because they just cut $175 million from LIHEAP. Not to mention, if you live in an area where there might be a hurricane or a disaster coming, they just cut almost $1 billion from FEMA's disaster relief. And, oh, on the west, if you live in an area where they have wildfires, they just cut $125 million to the wildland fire maintenance management program. So, hey, that's investments in the future, right? And what about the education? What about our kids? Ah, screw them, because I'm going to factories in China. They just cut $633 million from special ed, $86 million from student financial aid assistance, $116 million from higher ed. And we talked last night about the big bubble that's being created because the states have walked away from higher ed, the federal government's walked away from it, and now here again, more cuts. And for you right-wingers who love the border security people, we've got to have more people on the border marching up and down and shooting people. They just cut over a half a billion dollars from the Border Patrol. Over a half a billion dollars. And for folks who, you know, worried about, you know, nuclear security, $604 million slashed. And all you people at the FAA who want to go flying, $232 million slashed from it. And you look at this and you go, couldn't you possibly come up with a better idea? And this is what infuriates me about what's going on in Washington. The radical right wing, who everybody knew was going to hold the country hostage, the scorched earthers, they knew they won the second they got that sequester. And I remember talking about it back when it happened, going, this is what's going to go into effect. They keep saying that, you know, this is the reason they do it. Obama made us do it. And, you know, my take on it is, yeah, Obama came up with it. And like any parent, you know, myself included, like any parent, you want to put consequences out there. And you want to say, look, you know, you've got some recalcitrant, petulant children you've got to deal with. You got to get them to think there are consequences. And he thought that they actually cared about the health of the country, which is a huge mistake on his part. He actually thought that they cared. All they care about is, well, the political win. Not about you, not about me, not about the future of this country, but about the next election. And that's really what's wrong with our entire political system. We have got self-centered, narcissistic, egomaniacs sitting in our halls of Congress and in our state house, who it's all about them. It's not about we, the people. It's not about of, for, and by, we, the people. It's about them. It's about my party's political win, this team sport mentality. And I think most Americans are fed up with it, and I'm hoping I'm wrong. But most of the people that I know and most of the folks that I talk to, they're in the, what can we do? They're all in the same. They're all crooks. They're all in bed with the same people. They're all feeding from the same trough. The big money controls the entire system. They've bought our democracy. What can we do? Well, the reality is what we can do is we can begin to organize. We can begin to small groups. Small, dedicated groups saying, you know what, no more. Taking to the streets, talking to our friends, talking to our neighbors, in our communities. Going down to City Hall and occupying the office until you get an answer that you want. So that you say, you know what, no more of what you're doing. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on in Philadelphia today as parents and teachers and folks from across the city went to the Mayor Nutter's office and demanded that he support the school closure moratorium. We're going to find out from one of the parents how that went today. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
Have you ever stood outside on a dark, starry night and seen a meteor or shooting star?
Sometimes, after a meteor shower, people report hearing the meteors. Some exceptionally bright meteors have been reported as having a low hissing sound, like sizzling bacon.
For years, professional astronomers said meteors don't make a sound. Typically, a meteor burns up about 100 kilometers or 60 miles above Earth's surface. Because sound travels so much more slowly than light does, the rumblings of a large meteor shouldn't be heard for several minutes after you see the meteor streak across the sky. If that happened, a meteor 100 kilometers high would boom about 5 minutes after it appears.
But that doesn't happen. And what about meteors that seem to make a sound at the same time you're seeing them? Astronomers now speak of electrophonic meteors. The explanation is that meteors give off very low-frequency radio waves, which travel at the speed of light. Even though you can't directly hear radio waves, these waves can cause physical objects on the Earth's surface to vibrate. The radio waves cause a sound, which our ears might interpret as the sizzle of a meteor shooting by.
We have more on this subject, plus charts of events in the night sky at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
We need to show our children what our forefathers did before us, which was sit in and stand up for their rights. We weren't always granted our rights. We didn't always have schools for our children, and they're trying to take us back to that. And we have to fight back, because if we don't do anything, it'll be much worse.
Stop by the way.
As I've been saying, we need people who are willing to stand up, fight back, and say enough is enough, no more, we're not going to give ground. And it's you got to go to the streets. I mean, this is how my grandparents' generation created this country, created the middle class, created a legacy of the next generation doing better. And somehow that's being stolen from us. And now is the time. Right now is the time we need to be taken to the streets, which is why I've got Kia Hinton on the line. She is a Philadelphia parent of two children in a district that, you know, in the school district there, who's talking about closing a bunch of schools. They're asking the mayor, or demanding that the mayor of Philadelphia support the moratorium on these school closures. Kia, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem.
Explain to me exactly what's going on here. I understand there's, what, like 30 schools on the hit list?
Right, so we had 37 on the list, and we went to the streets and protested, and the SRC went back and took 10 schools off the list and put two more back on, so now we're at 29 school closings.
So now we go back to them and we get them to do it all over again until eventually they stop. Because I'm a firm believer, and we need local schools, neighborhood schools, the ones that you want your kid to walk to and play in and be part of that community, instead of what I'm seeing in your neck of the woods is the destruction of public education and the prioritization of these charter schools where, you know, who knows where the money goes then.
Right. Yes.
So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so you were at the mayor's office today. What happened?
So we met with the mayor. We had a few members from the black clergy. We had Jerry Mondesire from the NAACP. and it was a few other, another parent, and we sat with Mayor Nutter. He gave us 40 minutes of his time, and in the end, he, you know, felt like he failed to lead, you know, to lead us as a city and not closing schools. And trying to find alternatives that would help the community and help our children. And so we just left with still a fundamental difference on the scale of closing. And now we're just getting ourselves ready for Thursday's fight, which is the vote that the SRC is going to make to determine whether to close 29 schools.
Now, for the people in our listening area, the SRC, are these elected people or are these appointed people?
These are appointed people. Three of them are appointed from our governor, who has slashed $1 billion from education, and two of them are appointed by our city mayor.
So regardless, even if the mayor was on your side, you've got the governor's people sitting on that board, which the governor has shown time and time again. He's on the side of the privatizers, the profitizers, and the charter people.
Right. So, I mean, you know, we were able to gain the support of our city council. And so, you know, we thought that we would go to the mayor and, you know, and gain his help and his support in supporting a moratorium, because we're not the no people. We're not saying don't close any schools. We're saying let's slow things down and let's take a look at this and see how it's going to impact our communities and our children, and figure out a better way where it won't, you know, disrupt children's lives and cause a safety issue. And, you know, there's all kinds of issues that still haven't been addressed. And we're just like bulldozing, like closing schools down. We just feel like it's a rash and it's too fast. And, you know, we could do it better.
Yeah, and well, I've still yet to come up with this idea that somehow privatizing the public system is beneficial. And I look at the Chester Upland School District, where, you know, last year showed us that, you know, you see the money just flowing out of these charters to these consultants at a time when teachers aren't getting paid. And you look in the Reading area, where when it snows into the classroom, clearly to me, we're not investing and making public education held by we the people a priority in this state.
Clear to us too.
So what are the other, how many, what size is your group? Then the breakup, parents, teachers, students, who all participated today?
Okay, so, do you mean in our, when we occupied?
Yes.
The mayor's office? So it was, I would say it was about a good 10 of us.
Did you ever think that you would be the one out in the street being the one saying, hey, you know what, I'm going to stand and fight for my kids and for everybody else's kids as well? Did you think you would be the one, the face of this?
I never imagined that I would be as involved as I am. But, you know, I saw that my children weren't performing as well as I felt that they could perform. I saw that there were issues that were happening within the school, and just being a community member, you know, I've lived in this community for 36 years, and so I've seen, you know, the drugs come into my community and how it has affected our community as well as families. And so there's a lot of issues that our community members and our families and our children are dealing with, and I just feel like that it's not by mistake, it's by design. And I feel like if we don't stand up and take it to the streets and stand up for our rights, which those before us have done in the civil rights era, then we'll find ourselves reverting back to history where, you know, we won't have any institutions for our children to even attend.
Yeah,
and so I feel like it's my duty as a citizen and as a parent that, you know, I stand up and I say, no, we're not going to go for that. We're not having that. We're fighting back, and stand up for our children and stand up for our rights. I mean, this is a constitutional right that every child gets an education, and I'm going to stand up and do my part. and what I can enact.
And good for you. It always makes me feel good when you talk to people who, you know, they say, yeah, never in a million years did I ever imagine that I would be doing this. But you know what? The time came that someone had to do it, and it might as well have been me, and it might as well have been the people who were around me who took this fight on and had the courage and the bravery to do that.
Exactly. And coming together like this, it not only strengthens our communities, you know, it's a common bond that we all have. We all want our children to do well and to move on and do better than us ourselves do. And so, you know, if not, like you said, if not us, then who?
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, I took my daughter to the Progressive Summit they had this weekend, and people would say, well, why are you bringing a 10-year-old to something like this? And I'm going, because this is her country someday. She's going to have to learn how to do these things when it's her turn. And the same thing with your children. You know, the reason that you're out there partially is you're going to show your children how to take the torch in the next generation.
That's right. This is what our country was built on. You know, we have rights. We have the right to stand, the freedom of speech, to say, you know, what we believe, how we believe our country should be ran. This is a democracy. You know, never let government or, you know, tell the people how the government is going to be ran. Demos means the people.
Yep.
And that means that the government comes from us. We dictate how we want our government to be ran. And so this is what we're supposed to do. This is our right. And if we don't exercise that right, then we'll have those rights reverted and taken away from us. And we don't want that.
No. So what's the request here? We want to stop, just have a pause moment. Stop, don't close any of the schools yet. Actually do some studies. What's the ask?
Right. So we're asking that we hold off, do an analysis, and let's see how these school closures are going to affect our students. Let's take a closer look at what the cost is going to be, because we don't want to go ahead and close schools
right.
and end up finding ourselves in a situation like they did in D.C., where they closed schools and thought they were going to save money and ended up spending more money to maintain empty buildings. We don't want to be in that situation.
I'm with you.
You know, I understand that there's a fiscal crisis. We'll do this smart, you know, and utilize some, look for different funding sources. You know, one of the things that we looked into is community schools, where instead of closing the school, we could bring some resources into the school, maybe a health center or some wraparound services, something that's going to help the community as well as the children, and possibly bring in some revenue instead of just closing schools and having children, kindergartners and first graders, having to walk 30 and 40 minutes just to get to their closest school.
That's insane. It is absolutely insane. And by all means, do it in the light of day so we don't have a situation where, well, maybe one or two people make a boatload of money on all of this. Kia, I appreciate your coming on and talking to us about what you guys did today, and keep up the fight.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, Kia Hinton. Quick break, back with hour two of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In the first week of the sequester budget cuts aimed at reducing the federal deficit, United Steelworkers President Leo Girard says the political debate and the struggle over deficit reduction is the wrong fight to be having.
The biggest deficit we have in this country is a deficit on jobs. And we also believe we're having the wrong fight. The fight that we're having shouldn't be about deficit reduction. It should be about rebuilding the infrastructure of America and putting people back to work. And that will solve the deficit in the long term.
Girard says America also needs a high road economic strategy to sustain the American standard of living.
You can't sustain a consumer society on falling and declining standard of living and declining wages. So we've called for a high wage strategy similar to what they're doing in Europe and Scandinavian countries, who, by the way, got an unemployment rate now down to 5.5% rate. If we had a 5.5% rate of unemployment, we'd have no deficit issue.
The United Auto Workers say that Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's state takeover of the city of Detroit's finances is, quote, further evidence of his intent to erode democracy for the citizens of Michigan in general and the city of Detroit in particular, end quote. Snyder said March 1st he would appoint an emergency financial manager for Detroit. The UAW says dictating from the state capitol isn't the right formula to turn Detroit around. The state's emergency financial manager has the power to override the elected city government, to throw out existing labor contracts, change pension agreements, and sell off public assets, among other powers. Voters in Michigan repealed the financial emergency manager law in November, but Republicans controlling state government passed a new version of essentially the same law that voters had repealed. In 2014, employers will start offering health benefits to workers due to a requirement under the Affordable Care Act. But the question is, will workers buy into it? Jesse Russell looks at a new study.
ADP Research Institute has looked into the question of whether or not workers will buy into health benefits offered by employers and found mixed results, which mostly broke down by income levels. Perhaps not surprisingly, workers who earn more were more likely to opt in. ADP found that only 37% of workers in the $15,000 to $20,000 annual income range said that they were likely to buy into offered health benefits. However, that number jumped once the $20,000 threshold was breached, with 58% of those in the $20,000 to $25,000 income range saying they'd likely participate. Under the Act, employers who have more than 50 full-time employees are required to provide benefits to workers at a rate of 9.5% less than income. If employees opt out of buying insurance, there will be a penalty of either $95 or 1% of income starting in 2014. That penalty will increase substantially in the following years, reaching $695 or 2.5% of income in 2016. The study also found that the bigger cut of a paycheck a premium takes out, the less likely the employee is to stay on health care. The dropping out tends to occur once a premium starts taking up more than 3% of income.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I know many of you are interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average bridge in our state is 51 years old.
I've been saying facetiously for the last couple of weeks, ever since the governor made his State of the State address, that, you know, what's it going to take? Is it going to take a big giant sinkhole to swallow up the governor's motorcade or swallow someone up? And you saw over the weekend that in Florida, a giant sinkhole swallowed somebody up. And you go, well, that probably wasn't due to the fact that we haven't invested in infrastructure. It could be that, you know, we haven't controlled how rainwater has moved and we haven't done a good enough job with infrastructure. The report's still out on that. But I look here in Harrisburg, 41 sinkholes in the last year. And those, my friends, those are failures of improving infrastructure. And I worry, what's it going to take? Because what I've seen him propose, what our governor's proposed, nowhere close to enough. And if you look at the jobs numbers, this is an outstanding opportunity to help turn our economy around, which is why I've asked our good friend Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania's legislative director for the Laborers International Union of North America, to come talk to us. Abe, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome, Rick. Good to be with you.
I look at all of these sinkholes. You look at the one. Did you see that thing in Florida?
Yes, I did.
I mean, that is just mind-blowing. The earth just opens up and swallows someone in the house up with them.
Well, you know, like you pointed out in Harrisburg, there have been too many sinkholes and all kinds of disasters, but they could be avoided, Rick. And if you look at the infrastructure of Harrisburg, you'll see that many of these lines underneath the city, they have not been improved or maintained for hundreds, I mean, over 100 years. I believe that there was a sewer line at one point that had not been touched since 1889.
Yep.
And, I mean, these things have to be addressed, and you have to take proactive measures to prevent disasters. And heaven forbid anything would happen of that magnitude here in Harrisburg or in Pennsylvania, for that matter.
I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer that we would say, you know what, we want to have the best infrastructure. And I always go back, and as much as I don't like Thomas Friedman, I thought he was spot on when he used a statement about returning from Beijing to LAX, like it being going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones, because they're building stuff, they're investing, they're putting people to work. We're just kind of going, well, we'll wait and see what happens in a couple of years.
Well, that is the wrong approach to take. And Rick, I have to tell you, I heard some disturbing news in the Capitol today that House Republicans are looking to jam up any transportation legislation by getting rid of prevailing wage and some other measures that would protect workers. And they're not being serious about it. I mean, I was really disheartened to see that, first of all, I have not seen a bill. I have not seen a transportation package made available to the public, that is. I know that there's something internal floating around, but they're not taking this seriously. And with every day that goes by, that's $1 million more that needs to be put back in infrastructure spending in Pennsylvania. So I'm not hearing good things right now, and it's really frustrating because, like you said, I mean, this is a no-brainer. And by investing in our infrastructure, that creates jobs. And if you do this the right way, as my friend Rick Bloomingdale said, you will have 50 years of work if you do this correctly. And so why is there a hesitation by the governor and the legislature to really invest and put Pennsylvanians back to work while improving upon our bad infrastructure? I mean, it doesn't make sense. It is nothing more than mind-boggling. And, Rick, we need to be outraged by this. There needs to be a collective outrage, not just by the members of the legislature who believe in infrastructure, but by the public. We need to hold our leaders accountable for this.
Well, by me, every time my shocks go, or every time I got to replace my tires, or every time I've got a car repair because the roads are, you know, I come down Front Street in Harrisburg and I hit those, it never fails. I hit these potholes and the whole car just shakes. We should be repairing that road, but we're worried about the sinkholes.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I don't see any priorities here, Rick. I just see a lot of neglect. I see a lot of dragging of the feet. That's not leadership. And
well, let me ask
you that your listeners should really start making those phone calls, writing letters, and just putting pressure on these decision makers.
You know, you say you didn't see any leadership. I kind of look at it from a different perspective. The leadership is that they've been able to create a crisis or take advantage of a crisis, and now they're gonna turn the screws on working people. And I think, as you put it, you know, my representative Stephen Bloom out in the front of this, trying to take rights away from working people. And you know, to me, I look at this prevailing wage thing, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. But to me, this is my tax dollars saying, you know, we're going to raise up an industry and make sure we have a local industry and that there's some money being pushed into the local economy, and not that I'm going to use my tax dollars to be the one who leads the race to the bottom, paying poverty wages and having and promoting a transient workforce. That makes no sense to me.
That's right, Rick, because when you're paying those poverty wages and you're using a transient workforce, you're putting the public at peril. Those individuals are not qualified as skilled craftsmen to work on these projects. And what you're doing is you're saving a few pennies, and then you're putting people's safety at risk. It makes absolutely no sense, and it is unconscionable. And these dollars that are paid remain in local communities. I mean, working people buy groceries. Working people take their kids to school to buy school clothes. Working people have mortgages and car payments. All those good-paying, family-sustaining wages stay within their communities. They're recycled over and over again. So paying a guy $7 or $8 an hour with no health care benefits just doesn't – is so short-sighted that it's just mind-boggling. It's unbelievable. And I have debated Representative Bloom on these issues in the past, and I'll continue to do so because he's wrong on this. He and his cabal of folks from the Association of Builders and Contractors – and the Chamber of Commerce, they've got it all wrong. They've got it all wrong. They attack working people, and they attack prevailing wage, and they say that corporations are really the victims here. Contractors are really the victims here because they're paying way too much in terms of projects. And then they have the audacity to point at the school districts and say, well, they're the ones that want these tax savings. And I don't know of any contractor, Rick, and I've said this before in your program, I don't know of any contractor that's going to pass along any tax savings to the general public. They're going to pocket the difference.
Absolutely.
You know, this taking from the bottom and the pad to the top, it has to end at some point.
Well, there's a word for that. The Tea Party loves to use it. The redistribution of wealth, and that's exactly what it is. Help me walk through this prevailing wage thing, though, because I hear a lot of, you know, what the right loves to do is, oh, it's, you know, it's this mythical thing. It's a real complicated thing that we need to get rid of because, you know, we just evidently we're not smart enough to do it, is what they're trying to tell us. Walk me through this. What is this mythical thing, the prevailing wage? What is that?
Well, what the right wants you to believe, Rick, is that if you don't pay, that by paying somebody more than they're worth.
Well, what does that mean?
Is bad. Well, what they're trying to say is this. First of all, let's say you're pouring concrete or you're working a rebar project on a bridge.
Okay.
And you, for your training, for your experience, you should be getting paid, let's say, $17 an hour, which I know is low in some parts of the state, but let's just use $17 an hour here in central Pennsylvania. What they're trying to tell you is that the public taxpayer is getting hosed on that $17 an hour, and they can find somebody just as well qualified and trained to do that job for, let's say, $12 an hour. So they're saying, well, you're going to be saving the school district at least $5 an hour on or the public, $5 an hour on that job. But what they're not telling you is they're not going to be using a skilled craftsman who has a tremendous amount of experience, knows exactly what he or she is doing in terms of laying that rebar, working on that concrete, making sure that everything is safe, making sure that everything is done to standards and on time. The contractors will not tell you that the people that they use at a lower rate are providing inferior work, which will eventually lead to a public safety hazard. That's what they're not telling you. And it's a real problem in Pennsylvania where we are not defining the problems in those words. We are letting the other side say, hey, we could be fining people for just as much or as
we can use prison labor. We can use prison labor.
That's right. We can use prison labor. We can use anybody that's not qualified because it's going to cost less. And the other thing that they throw at you is, well, with the unemployment rate so high in certain industries, you can find just about anybody who wants to work because these union folks, they don't want to work. All they want to do is work on projects that pay way too much money. And, of course, we are demonized, which is completely wrong. And what we need to do is have a better message and say, look, you get exactly what you pay for. You have skilled craftsmen, skilled tradesmen with tons of experience who know how to work on these projects and are going to make sure that you get the very best value because you are getting the very best value. These wages are family-sustaining wages. They're good-paying wages. And the other thing we have to keep in mind is the construction season is not 12 months
out of
the year.
Right.
And when it rains, you don't work.
And you look at what they did.
You
look at what they did to these construction workers in this last unemployment bill that was just devastating and destructive. And again, led by folks like Stephen Bloom. And what gets me, and I'm sure I know a couple of people who work in construction because they view themselves as craftsmen, as skilled labor, as professionals. And what I'm getting from people like Bloom and folks on the right is, hey, any Tom, Dick, or Harry can do those jobs. We can get anybody in there to do it. It's a menial job. There's no real professionalism there. And that's part of what I see the attacks as. I'm curious what you think.
I agree with you 100%. And there's nothing menial about performing some of these tasks. You have to have a certain degree of experience and training. You have to be certified in many of these jobs, which means that you start at the very bottom. And one of the best things about the labor movement and trades and craftsmen is that they have to work to get to the next level. Opportunities are provided for you, whether it's training, whether experience, whether it's hands-on experience on the job. These are valuable things that allow an individual to move up. And what they want you to think is that any, like you said, any Tom, Dick, or Harry could be out there pouring concrete, could be working with rebar. Oh, that's just manual labor. Anyone can do it. A trained SEAL could do it. Well, that's not the case at all. And it's an insult to workers, and it's an insult to the public as well. These individuals are highly skilled folks who have put in their time, who have done good work, and have really performed at a level that the public deserves. And, you know, it's an insult to the public as well by putting individuals that are not qualified, not trained in these positions. I mean, contractors are going to pay them peanuts. Yep. They're going to go back in their communities, and they're not going to do well either because their poverty rates are going to be higher, and so society has to kick in and help them with that as well. So what they're doing is they're selling us a big lie. They're saying that for less you can get more, which is absolute nonsense. In fact, it's an absolute insult. That's what it is.
And I saw one of the local TV stations where I live pumping this idea that, you know, a school district paid $41,000 for too much for a roof, and they could have gotten it much cheaper. And I'm going, well, hold on. I think I don't want my kids sitting in that classroom where the roof was put on by somebody who didn't know what the hell they were doing.
That's right, Rick. And I saw that same report. It was a hatchet job because the reporter didn't ask the right questions. And when I spoke to the individual who was actually interviewed, he admitted to me that he didn't use half the quotes that were there because the piece was so biased against labor. They're trying to make us the bad guys when all we want to do is find good-paying jobs that help our communities, that help our families, and really do the right thing. You want to put the best-trained people on the job to make sure that the job is done correctly, under budget, on time, and that eventually the public benefits from it because you're going to have a safe bridge, you're going to have a well-paved road, which is going to last a very long time. That's where you find your cost savings in doing it right the first time.
Right, and doing it quickly with people who know what they're doing. Last question I've got on this prevailing wage issue, because I keep hearing people in the center part of the state, well, you know, why should we be paying, you know, what it costs somebody in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, you know, because they're always pitting Philadelphia and Pittsburgh against the middle. Is that reality?
No, that's not reality, Rick. The Pittsburgh and Philadelphia rates are what they are. You're not going to be paying Pittsburgh and Philadelphia rates in the middle of the state. What you're doing is you're taking an average. That's what you're doing. And let's talk a little bit about that. What the contractors are supposed to do is they're supposed to send the Department of Labor and Industry rates of what they're paying their employees.
Right.
They're not doing that. And I asked a Republican legislator why they're not doing that. And they said, well, let's say, for instance, Abe, that we have construction companies, and I have this tremendous backhoe operator that I'm paying, let's say, $10 an hour. Well, if you see what I'm paying him, you're going to go in there and swoop in and say, well, I'm going to pay him $11 an hour.
Well, isn't that a good thing for him?
Absolutely.
Did I miss
Absolutely,
something?
But it's bad for the contractor. So you see, these narrow-minded Republican legislators from central Pennsylvania, Rick, because there's not an exception. There's not one exception to that rule in Pennsylvania. They're short-sighted, and what they'd rather do, again, is take from the bottom, pad the top, help their corporate friends, help the contractors, and forget about the little guy, the guy that makes his living, makes her living, using their hands and their back, and that's just not right.
And that's why we should be screaming at them early, often, get this transportation bill done, and leave the workers the hell alone.
That's right. Exactly. It benefits everyone.
Yep. Abe, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Likewise, Rick. Thank you.
I look forward to talking to you again as this moves down the pipe. Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for the Laborers International Union of North America. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Here's a diabolical idea from the hottest level of hell, down where Wall Street's fiendish schemers and scammers dwell. Conspiring with state lawmakers, such powerhouse banks as J.P. Morgan Chase, U.S. Bancorp, and Bank of America have devised a new way to enrich themselves by, get ready to gag, ripping off unemployed Americans. As Lily Tomlin has said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. These bankers have slithered into the process that states use to pay monthly jobless benefits to hard-hit people. These payments used to be mailed to recipients or deposited directly into their bank accounts. But Wall Street lobbyists, using phrases like win-win, have enticed states to switch the payment system to bank-issued debit cards. This saves states the cost of mailing or direct depositing the money, but banks don't do anything for free. Someone must pay for distributing the benefits to individuals. Guess who? Yes, the unemployed. Now, each month, the cost of distribution plus a generous profit for the bank are automatically deducted from the meager benefits the jobless receive. Then the bank hits them with ATM fees and other charges for using the card. How handy! In the sense that it puts bankers' hands right into the pockets of unemployed people, forcing those in dire need to pay millions of dollars in unnecessary fees to some of the richest bankers in the land. This is Jim Hightower saying, California, Indiana, Kansas, Maryland, and Nevada don't even allow recipients the choice of direct deposit, forcing them into the clutches of a particular bank, which violates federal law. But the whole system of profiteering on jobless people is an obscene violation of America's fundamental sense of morality. For information and action, go to National Consumer Law Center at nclc.org. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
We need a third party to save this country. Not Ron Paul and the Ron Paulites. No, we need a legitimate third party to challenge the current system that we have. Because I don't believe that the Republican Party, although I ran as a Republican, I have been voting Republican for decades, I don't believe the Republican Party has the ability to rebrand itself.
I look at this, and again, you go back to Stephen Bloom, a guy who's, you know, someone got a bee in his bonnet in the form of a campaign donation, I would bet, to go after this thing, prevailing wage. And most people don't know what it is. And, you know, like we were talking about with Abe, I mean, it's to me, it's one of those pieces of flooring that says, you know what, we're going to draw this line in the sand, and people doing this line of work, this is the bottom. This is where we want that industry. And we want to promote a local industry. We want to promote local people doing local projects. We don't want to keep bringing in people from who knows where to do who knows what. And we want it to reverberate throughout the local economy. It's called providing a floor to your economy and making sure that we're all doing a little bit better off. But what you get from people like Bloom is this jealousy. Well, you know, they're getting paid so much money, and they have this belief that, you know, that's not hard work. That's not skilled work. It's absolutely mind-blowing. And just this blind faith ideology, it's just frustrating on a number of levels. But it's not just, you know, just not just our legislature. You look across the country over to Washington State, one of their House members, a guy named Ed Orcutt. He is the ranking Republican on the Transportation Committee there in Washington State, who wrote one of his constituents, emailed one of the constituents who, you know, just disagreed with him for this representative supporting a new tax on the sales of bicycles. So the guy, his constituent says, hey, I'm not thrilled with this. You know, it's wrong. You shouldn't do it. Because this tax is in conjunction with this transportation bill that they're pushing through. And, you know, people said, hey, you know, don't do it. So Mr. Orcutt writes back. He says, if I'm not mistaken, cyclists, that's the wrong spelling, has an increased heart rate and respiration, that means that the act of riding a bicycle results in greater emission of carbon dioxide from the rider. He continues to say, since CO2 is deemed to be a greenhouse gas and a pollutant, bicyclists are actually polluting when they ride. He added more, saying that when people drive their cars, they're helping to pay for roads, and that bicyclists, they need to start paying for the roads that they ride on rather than the motorists pay. He was reached for a comment by the people at the Seattle Bike Blog, who said, you know, do you have any evidence? Do you have anything that would back up your claim that that riding a bike is worse for the environment than driving a car? And he admitted that, well, no. No, doesn't have any evidence. Just reached behind him and popped out a good story. And just on its face, think of how ludicrous this is, that someone riding a bicycle is creating more pollution than someone driving a car. And this, to me, pretty much lays out the Republican ideology. It's all in the belief and nothing in the fact. Well, you know, that person may have a hamburger and he may be a little gaseous, and, you know, as he's riding and pedaling and everything works through and, you know, a little bit something comes out there, you know, that could be just like an exhaust pipe, right? Right? These are people that we've put into halls of power. Doesn't it scare you? Scares me. And you look at what we should be doing. I want more people riding their bikes. I want more people taking public transportation. A study just out using Census Bureau data saying that nearly 80% of workers who drive to work, you know, people like you, people like me, nearly 80% of them drive by themselves. Think about that for a second. Think about the guy in front of you and the people all around, they're single commuters. And at some point, I'm hoping that we have leaders who go, you know what, it'd be a good idea if we got people off the roads. Because we can't keep building bigger roads. I mean, there's only so much space. I mean, we could start stacking them on top of each other. But that'd be a nightmare. So maybe a public transportation system. I remember what we talked about yesterday. Amtrak saw a record number of customers in 2012, a 55% increase since 1997. In fact, rail is the fastest growing mode of transportation right now, especially when you look at the Northeast, the D.C. to New York, New York to New England routes. And what you hear from Republicans screaming, oh, well, we're subsidizing them. You know how much money we've spent on roads and bridges over the last couple years? Huge amounts. In fact, the Highway Trust Fund had some $50 billion in it for the last 4 years alone. $50 billion. That's more than we've spent on Amtrak since Amtrak's existence. And you go, shouldn't we be thinking about the future? Don't we want to have visionary leaders? And, well, no, evidently not. And for me, I want to get those people on the road ahead of me, off the road. And really what I'd like to do is I would like to get off the road, personally. I would prefer to take a train into work every day if I could. That's probably not going to happen with the people we've got sitting in our halls of power, but it would still be a nice idea, a nice option. I like the idea of options. You know, we hear the right talk about choice an awful lot. Oh, we love choice, except for getting to work, which means you have to drive. And one of the things that I loved is over the weekend when I was at the Keystone Progress Progressive Summit, one of the women was talking about privatization, and she talked in Pittsburgh where they privatized the parking garages and the meters. And in the contract, according to her, there is a clause in there that if the city or the county increases public transportation a certain amount, that the city has to pay the people who privatize the parking authority a certain amount of money to mandate that all of their spaces are filled, because the fewer people coming into the city obviously means fewer people parking, which means that they can't keep jacking up prices, which means that they're going to lose money, and heaven forbid that people who we've privatized our things to lose money on the risk, because, you know, there's no such thing as risk anymore. Which is why we privatize the public good, especially when there's the public purse backing it up. It just blows the mind. Gonna take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
Have you ever stood outside on a dark, starry night and seen a meteor or shooting star?
Sometimes, after a meteor shower, people report hearing the meteors. Some exceptionally bright meteors have been reported as having a low hissing sound, like sizzling bacon.
For years, professional astronomers said meteors don't make a sound. Typically, a meteor burns up about 100 kilometers or 60 miles above Earth's surface. Because sound travels so much more slowly than light does, the rumblings of a large meteor shouldn't be heard for several minutes after you see the meteor streak across the sky. If that happened, a meteor 100 kilometers high would boom about 5 minutes after it appears.
But that doesn't happen. And what about meteors that seem to make a sound at the same time you're seeing them? Astronomers now speak of electrophonic meteors. The explanation is that meteors give off very low-frequency radio waves, which travel at the speed of light. Even though you can't directly hear radio waves, these waves can cause physical objects on the Earth's surface to vibrate. The radio waves cause a sound, which our ears might interpret as the sizzle of a meteor shooting by.
We have more on this subject, plus charts of events in the night sky at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
As far as my 2008 compensation goes, you know, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
I could get a 300% bonus. I wish at the when I left a job, I've never had a job where they said, you know, we like you so much, we wish you wouldn't leave, but here's a 300% bonus on the way out the door. I've never had that job. Maybe it's just I've worked for the wrong people. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So the verdict is in the case in Philadelphia, where Occupy Philly said, you know what, we're going to go and sit in and, well, occupy a Wells Fargo branch because, well, we want them to stop foreclosing on people. In fact, as I remember the story, it was a citizen's foreclosure on the bank because the bank, well, responsible for millions of dollars in tax dollars to the local school district not being paid. One of those defendants is a good friend of the program, Dustin Slaughter. Dustin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks. How are you doing?
So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's good not to go to jail.
It's wonderful not to go to jail, but
especially when you're right.
I'm sorry?
Especially when you're right.
Damn straight.
So walk me through this whole thing. How did this happen? Walk me through it.
Well, I mean, as you kind of laid it out pretty well there, we did a citizen's foreclosure on a Wells Fargo branch in Center City, Philadelphia. The jury of our peers came back this afternoon and basically vindicated our message and basically said that Wells Fargo is guilty of illegal foreclosures, not just on the people of Philadelphia, but military families, as you might have heard this week.
Of
a bad swap deals against the Philadelphia school district and a whole host of other crimes.
Yeah, oops, we just foreclosed on, what was it, 700 military families? Oops.
700, right.
That was an accident, sorry.
Right.
And, you know, I give people credit who are willing to stand up and say no, and folks like you going into this place and say, you know what, we're gonna draw attention to this, even if it means... this was November of 2011, and now all this time later, you finally have a trial. It looks like the wheels of justice, well, grind kind of slow.
Well, they do. Just to clarify, however, we did go to trial about 6 months after our initial hearing, and a municipal court judge did find us guilty. But we did have the option of taking this to a jury trial if we felt that we were in the right to do so, and so we decided that we were going to go ahead and continue carrying this message to people of Philadelphia.
So now that you've been found not guilty, you've been vindicated, where does this go from here? What's the message going forward?
Well, I mean, a number of us will continue to ally with wonderful community organizations who are already giving, you know, fighting the good fight here in Philadelphia to save public education, and we hope to be doing a lot more work with people facing foreclosure.
So what I find interesting is that, you know, the 12 of you, they put on trial, and as you've said, you know, twice now, I guess, and how many of the Wells Fargo people have they put on trial?
Absolutely none.
Is that going to happen? I mean, I look at the people who have, you know, basically destroyed our nation and pretty much the globe, and have stolen, you know, unfathomable amounts of wealth. Have we had anyone held accountable for this? Anybody held to account?
We haven't, as a matter of fact. And I'm sure your listeners are quite aware of the wonderful performance that the newly elected Senator Elizabeth Warren put on in the Senate, where she basically asked point blank, you know, talking to bank regulators, are, you know, is anyone going to be facing trial? Any of these bank executives are going to be facing trial. Why haven't you done? Why are you planning on doing it? And she couldn't get a straight answer from them, because, you know, it's a two-tiered legal system. There's one set of laws for people like you and I, and there's one set of laws for the elite.
Yeah, and I always point back to the there was a story a couple of weeks ago that I talked about, a woman who worked at Walmart, ate some cookies. She's going to probably do a year in prison.
There you go.
For cookies.
It's a travesty.
And yet the people who have done so much harm to our communities, so much harm to the family fabric of this nation, nothing.
Absolutely nothing. That's right. And, you know, foreclosures are continuing. That's here, not just here in Philadelphia, but across the country, obviously. And our school system here in Philadelphia, and, you know, obviously we're not the only city, but these bad swap deals that a lot of these banks pull on municipalities, they're really hurting our children's future, as well as public sector workers.
And it's important that you bring that up because, you know, earlier in the program we talked to a woman who, you know, was at Mayor Nutter's office today, you know, occupying the office there, saying, hey, we want you to sign on to this moratorium to closing any more schools. And you look at the money that these big banks, these too big to fail banks, have extracted, stolen, whatever words you want to use, from the district and all of the financial heartache that they've caused. Not saying that the SRC is right, but you know, you can see that, hey, the money's been stolen. It's been put somewhere. It's not going into education.
It's definitely not going into education. In fact, I think it's pretty well documented at this point, at least here in Philadelphia, that there's a charter school corporation called the Boston Group, who clearly is not even from Philadelphia, who has a significant and unduly sway on education policy here in the city.
Because they've got the money. You know,
they've got the money.
And looking at today's verdict, where do you go from here? I mean, this is a huge verdict, and I think nationwide this is something that's going to get attention because, look, as you pointed out, you know, it looked at the Wells Fargo and their practices, and it pointed the finger back at them.
That's right. And, you know, I think it's a significant victory on a number of levels, although it's not whole justice, obviously, because none of the CEOs have been brought to trial yet. But it also speaks to the power of free speech over corporate property rights. It's a really interesting verdict that came down today. So I don't really know what's going to happen next. I wish we are people that were vindicated today. We've been really kind of pushing, telling as many people as we can, you know, ask District Attorney Seth Williams, when is he going to stop prosecuting activists and start going after big banks? There's a well publicized procedure going on right now up in Manhattan, and there's a U.S. district prosecutor who has been filing a number of lawsuits against Wells Fargo. So if this federal prosecutor can go ahead and do that, why can't someone like Seth Williams go ahead and do something like that to a bank that's clearly hurting the city so badly?
Well, because it's easier to beat up on people who basically don't have the resources of a Wells Fargo.
Exactly.
And that's what infuriates me, which is why I do believe we need to, and we should have from the beginning, been breaking up these too big to fail banks instead of making them even bigger than too big to fail.
Absolutely.
So I give you credit. I give you congratulations on the victory, and I hope you continue to the fight as we continue down the road. What should we be doing now that, you know, in the months coming? Because there's still a crisis. The people are still losing their homes. They're still being foreclosed on. Wells Fargo is one of the key players in this. What should we be doing from here forward?
Well, the best advice I can give your listeners, and this is just speaking from personal experience, is to get out there, get out in the streets, get off your keyboards, and get out there and really fight these banks, take it to their lobbies. Take it to, you know, the politicians' doorsteps, and don't give up. Put your body on the line, do it nonviolently, and I think the arc of justice is long, but it definitely can get to a point where people win. So.
Yep. Well, congratulations, Dustin. I appreciate the time, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, Dustin Slaughter, thanks so much. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the Vulcan dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Ask Me Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about the potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money. Even if it has been money for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
That economic law. The law. I guess I didn't learn that law in economics courses. It's a law, you know. It is. It's a law. Wow. But again, it's a blind faith belief. And you give the right credit, they have their blind faith beliefs. Much like this one. How many people have heard of the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now? For my right-wing friends, you'll know them as ACORN. ACORN has been defunct now for, well, it's going on 4 years. 2009, they were defunded, pretty much closed up the shop. Done. There is no more ACORN. None. But you listen to the right-wingers. In fact, there was a public policy polling poll done after the 2012 presidential election where almost half of the Republicans surveyed believed that ACORN stole the 2012 election, even though they have been defunct, done, no longer, no members, nothing. No organization, nothing, no offices, no business cards, nothing since 2009. Nothing. And I look at Hal Rogers, a Republican congressman from Kentucky. He introduced a short-term budget bill. Now, understand, Rogers is the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. And in his short-term budget bill, he seeks to defund ACORN, which hasn't existed since 2009. And you kind of got to go, you know, what the hell is going on? Is it just political theater where they keep stoking the fire? Got to get those minions fired up that ACORN's back and they want money. They don't exist.
And what's interesting to me is they don't exist because of a lie. Trumped up, nonsensical BS, a flat-out lie. And the only reason the guy who did this hit job didn't go to jail is he was able to, well, he was able to wiggle his way out of it and come and broker some deal to keep him out of prison. You remember the video, don't you? You had James O'Keefe was the guy's name who dressed up like a pimp. And in the video, it looks like he walked in his fly guy outfit and sat down and was talking about running a sex slave ring and smuggling young girls into the U.S. and asking how Acorn could help. And if you watched the video with the very, very creative editing, it looked like that. But when O'Keefe turned over the unedited footage, he wasn't wearing the pimp costume. He wasn't doing any of the things that the video made it look like. In fact, the Government Accountability Office issued a report in 2010 that had cleared Acorn of all wrongdoing. Of course, after the fact that they were already done. And I love this right-wing attack machine that gets onto something and they won't let go. And Acorn is one of those. You know, the fraud in the election that the right, let me say, see these Acorn people, they're stealing elections. The fraud was against them. They were not the ones who were committing the fraud. The fraud was committed against them. They hired people to go out and get voter registrations. And the people who were supposed to be out getting those voter registrations were just making stuff up. And by law, when those are turned in, they had to turn them in to the Elections Commission and say, look, hey, we think there's something wrong with these. You should take a look at it. And that's what they did. But facts, well, facts be damned. It's the frame that the right wing loves. You know, the other frame that the right uses that I really like is the Obamacare has death panels in it. And I've asked, you know, and I've asked some pretty high up officials if there are, because there's some folks I could do without if you put me on the death panel, but there aren't. Until I saw this story out of Bakersfield, California. And I'm sure you've seen this as well. An 87-year-old woman who was a resident of a senior living facility, living being the key word, she was having, I don't know what the problem was, but she was on the ground, she was unresponsive, she was had shallow breathing, she was really in a bad way. Well, the staff at this senior living facility called 911, and the 911 operator is saying, hey, you've got to do something. Here, I'll walk you through performing CPR. The only way this woman's probably going to live is if you help her. Well, the staff member at this senior living facility refused. Said, company policy, can't, sorry. Not allowed by rule. And when I was reading this, I'm thinking back, you know, the death panels. This is a death panel, right? Don't you think? You've got a corporate board who said, you know, our policy is that we don't have anyone other than our trained people do those things on our facility. And this woman now, who knows? The police are trying to figure out whether there's going to be any criminal charges. But here's this woman lying on the floor, dying. She had, you know, not breathing, no pulse. You know, when the paramedics arrived, you know, 7-10 minutes later. And you go, you know, just as a decent human being, wouldn't you do something? And the 911 operator's going, hey, is there a gardener, any staff, anybody? Can you flag someone down in the street to help this woman? And, well, the company is now saying, well, you know what? By law, it's not licensed to provide medical care to any of its residents. So, we don't have to. And I guess the question then becomes, you know, Because part of me hopes that the woman who did nothing, that we lock someone like that up. Because how do you stand there and watch someone die without doing a thing? Like, you could go, oh, she called 911. That was nice. That also her job. But to me, company policy be damned. So I see the story that here in Pennsylvania, that probably wouldn't happen. At a couple of these different facilities who say, well, you know, we have skilled people on the staff. And I ask you, what would you do? I mean, if you were in that situation, what would you do? Company policy says you can't do it. And part of me understands the corporate mentality. Someone would be sued. Because we do live in a very litigious society. Which is why tomorrow when it snows, or tonight when it starts snowing, or whenever the snow hits the dusting or the 2 or 3 inches we're going to get, I'm sure my local school district will cancel school because, hey, who wants to put a bus on the road and have 30, 40 kids in it and have it hit a pole and have 30, 40 different lawsuits? I get it. But, you know, at the end of this, it's about being part of a decent society. And, man, this story just, it was one of those moments that you go, man, I don't want to get old. You know, you move into one of these communities thinking, you know, oh, there's going to be people around. You know, you don't want to live in your home because if something like this happens and you're there by yourself. Well, there was somebody there, and they didn't do anything because of corporate policy, which is another reason why I don't think these things should be run by for-profit corporations. They should be run by we the people. And the other part of this is even if the woman who worked there did do something and did it wrong, we have good Samaritan laws that would have protected the company, would have protected that woman. I sat there and I'm reading and I'm just, you know, because I think about my grandmother. My grandmother's not much, you know, she's pushing that wrench. She's pushing heading to one of these living communities. What if that was my grandmother? I'd be furious. So I guess, would you do it? Because I would. Because I think it's the right thing to do. And maybe that's just me. And maybe the time we live in is that litigious mentality. Now we got to think corporate. I mean, do you really want corporations having that kind of control? And it brought me back to the Obamacare fight, the whole thing over death panels and the whole thing of do we want government having this? And damn right I do. Because you know what? We don't have any say over this. Now I'm hoping that the people who live in this senior living community are packing their bags as we speak and leaving in droves. And one would argue, well, that's the capitalist system and, you know, the freedom of consumers to make the choice. Well, you know what? That woman, that 87-year-old woman, she didn't have that choice. Because I bet you she thought that any decent person, they would have done something. Don't you think? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there at the website, thericksmithshow.com. You can also get the program via our Stitcher app on your smartphone, Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher. As always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Look forward to the contact. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three of the program. Stick around. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In the first week of the sequester budget cuts aimed at reducing the federal deficit, United Steelworkers President Leo Girard says the political debate and the struggle over deficit reduction is the wrong fight to be having.
The biggest deficit we have in this country is a deficit on jobs. And we also believe we're having the wrong fight. The fight that we're having shouldn't be about deficit reduction. It should be about rebuilding the infrastructure of America and putting people back to work. And that will solve the deficit in the long term.
Girard says America also needs a high road economic strategy to sustain the American standard of living.
You can't sustain a consumer society on falling and declining standard of living and declining wages. So we've called for a high wage strategy similar to what they're doing in Europe and Scandinavian countries, who, by the way, got an unemployment rate now down in the 5.5% rate. If we had a 5.5% rate of unemployment, we'd have no deficit issue.
The United Auto Workers say that Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's state takeover of the city of Detroit's finances is, quote, further evidence of his intent to erode democracy for the citizens of Michigan in general and the city of Detroit in particular, end quote. Snyder said March 1st he would appoint an emergency financial manager for Detroit. The UAW says dictating from the state capitol isn't the right formula to turn Detroit around. The state's emergency financial manager has the power to override the elected city government, to throw out existing labor contracts, change pension agreements, and sell off public assets, among other powers. Voters in Michigan repealed the financial emergency manager law in November, but Republicans controlling state government passed a new version, essentially the same law that voters had repealed. In 2014, employers will start offering health benefits to workers due to a requirement under the Affordable Care Act. But the question is, will workers buy into it? Jesse Russell looks at a new study.
ADP Research Institute has looked into the question of whether or not workers will buy into health benefits offered by employers and found mixed results, which mostly broke down by income levels. Perhaps not surprisingly, workers who earn more were more likely to opt in. ADP found that only 37% of workers in the $15,000 to $20,000 annual income range said that they were likely to buy into offered health benefits. However, that number jumped once the $20,000 threshold was breached, with 58% of those in the $20,000 to $25,000 income range saying they'd likely participate. Under the Act, employers who have more than 50 full-time employees are required to provide benefits to workers at a rate of 9.5% less than income. If employees opt out of buying insurance, there will be a penalty of either $95 or 1% of income starting in 2014. That penalty will increase substantially in the following years, reaching $695 or 2.5% of income in 2016. The study also found that the bigger cut of a paycheck a premium takes out, the less likely the employee is to stay on health care. The dropping out tends to occur once a premium starts taking up more than 3% of income.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In a few moments, I will sign the North American Free Trade Act into law. The environmental and labor side agreements negotiated by our administration will make this agreement a force for social progress as well as economic growth.
Well, we have been again and again. And again, and this president, three more of them, and to me, Colombia being the worst of them. And now we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, another one of these. And what some people are saying is this is probably going to be the last one because there's supposedly, and again, I'm not allowed to know because I'm not one of the 600 lobbyists who has access to this, since most of this has been done really, really secretively. This could be the end of them because there's an add-on feature, as I understand, that you know, just keep adding people to it. So there's no more congressional authority, no more you or me having any say, none of that. And, you know, I go back into the George H.W. Bush years where, you know, they were asking for fast-track authority so they could get these, they could rush these trade agreements through without you or me or any, you know, any of those concerns. And I keep seeing the same voices saying kind of the same thing, which is why we've asked Bob Cash to come on the program, director of the Texas Fair Trade Coalition. Bob, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure. Thank you for asking.
You know, I look at this thing, and I do we have fast-track authority in place for Obama? Or because I didn't think there was.
It is not in place currently. And, in fact, that's our biggest priority right now is to make sure that it doesn't get into place.
Because I want to make sure that we have oversight. I want to make sure that there are hearings. I want to see things on C-SPAN. I want to have an opportunity to weigh in on it.
Well, I think that's what a lot of people don't understand about this fast-track so-called trade promotion authority. And it was a Nixon-era law that basically took the constitutional right of Congress and gave it to the executive branch, gave it to the president, by which the president can negotiate trade agreements, which, like this one, nobody's seen yet. Once they're agreed to, present them to Congress, and Congress has no right to debate or make amendments. It's just an up or down vote.
And so you're not one of the 600, I guess there are 600 lobbyists who have access to this. You're not one of them?
I'm not one of them. I don't think you're one of them, and neither is your congressman or my congressman or congresswoman.
And there's something, to me, something seriously wrong with that. I thought that's where we were supposed to have these treaties and these trade bills going through that little thing called Congress.
Well, the problem is it goes through it, but with this fast track, it like I said, on a fast track with a very little chance to look at it and no chance to change it.
What bothers me, though, is this is bipartisan. I mean, you know, it was. You go back to NAFTA. It was dreamt up during the Reagan years. It was rammed. It was all negotiated during the Bush years, signed by Clinton. And then here we go. We're going into all of the other trade agreements that haven't done much to help working people. I keep looking at the numbers at working class wages going down, but that top 1% and the 1/10 of 1% doing wildly well.
Well, you know, it's really interesting to me is it's a perfect storm, these agreements, in that it's not like the workers of the other countries involved that our jobs are being shipped to are actually being helped either.
Right.
They're treaties that help the 1% economic elite of all the countries and pretty much lower the wages, lower the living standards, human rights, and degrade the environment of all the countries involved.
Yeah, because I go back and I look at NAFTA, and you know, we were told, boy, it was going to raise NAFTA, or the Mexican standard of living wasn't going to hurt us much, but it was going to really raise them up, because, you know, a rising tide, all boats, that whole thing. Their boat looks like it's grounded.
Well, of course, in Mexico, I believe it's in the first 5 years, factory wages dropped 20% after the passage of NAFTA, and family farms in Mexico were devastated.
Yeah.
One of the reasons for the large migration was because the NAFTA basically killed the family farm system.
Agribusiness came in and destroyed them.
Right.
And what people
compete with agribusiness.
And maybe you can confirm it, because I think what most people don't realize is when Mexico signed on to NAFTA, they actually had to change their constitution to steal land away from communities where the community could farm on.
That's right. So the constitution had been set up by the Mexican Revolution, but they had to change the constitution to give basically private companies the right to buy land.
So let me ask you, one of the things that came out of NAFTA, and this is what's bothering me in looking at all of the trade agreements, is this idea, this concept of least restrictive trade barrier. And what it is basically saying us as a sovereign nation, we can't pass a law that someone else doesn't have. And I've heard the story that India is thinking of suing us because they want to market cigarettes to our children, because we say you can't market cigarettes to children in this country. But they're considering suing us for that. And it makes me wonder, you know, at some level, is this idea of least restrictive trade barrier something good for us?
Oh, I think it's absolutely bad for us and bad for all the people of the other countries involved. The AFL-CIO Executive Council this week put out a statement, and if I could just read a little bit of it about what you were just talking about. The most significant example of the systemic tilt of U.S. trade policy towards the richest 1% is the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism, which published reports indicate has been proposed for inclusion in the TPP. The investor state language in the current trade model allows a single foreign-owned business to bypass domestic courts to challenge a democratically elected government's choice of labor, clean water, or food safety regulations, or any other legislative or judicial decision in an international arbitration forum. No such right accrued to workers, citizens, civil society groups, state or local governments. And so it's, rather than a trade deal, it's really a rights deal, increased rights for multinational corporations to challenge safety laws, consumer
all of them.
Safety law, right.
Minimum wage, maximum hour, health and safety, everything. Challenge every law that we've got on the books. And, you know, I go back to the 2012 presidential election when Mitt Romney said corporations are people. This, what you're saying and what the AFL-CIO is saying, they're basically corporations on steroids or people on steroids.
Well, yeah, that's right. And, you know, last time we talked, you talked to me when I was in Addison, Texas, where we had a demonstration of 300 unionists, environmental folks, Occupy folks, because the TPP negotiations were taking place there. And I think at that time I said that this was TPP was turning into NAFTA on steroids. Well, since that time, it really is NAFTA on steroids because Canada and Mexico, the original partners with the U.S. in NAFTA, have now joined in the TPP negotiations. And it appears as if Japan is likely to do so, too.
Let me ask you, Bob, you know, because I get a lot of flack from some of my right-wing friends who say, wow, you're just anti-trade. And I usually reply back, I'm not against the idea of trade. I think trade is not a bad thing. I think it helps when it's done right. Instead of, you know, this idea of you know, lowest, you know, least restrictive trade barrier, why don't we have a set of values, a floor underneath all workers' feet so that we all do better instead of all doing worse?
I couldn't agree with you more. And the fact is that done right, trade agreements could promote balanced trade, which could promote the economies and the living standards of working people in these countries. And right now, Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio has legislation, the 21st Century Trade Agreements Act, which lays out the outline of what a fair trade policy would be and why it would be something beneficial to all people, not just the 1%.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, the 1%, they're the ones who pay the lobbyists who go in and have access to this stuff, and they're the ones who have the pen right now to write this stuff, which is what's angering me to no end. And, you know, the president had mentioned a trade agreement with Europe. And my first thought when our president said that was, well, who's going to be pulling who? Are we going to be pulling them down or are they going to be pulling us up? And, you know, if history shows anything, we're going to be pulling them down.
Well, unfortunately, that was what you could infer from statements made by a U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk the day after the president made his speech. And which it sounded like wanted the kind of language with the EU, with the European Union, that are in these other agreements, which have actually lowered working conditions, environmental standards, attack democratic concepts and sovereignty all around the board.
Let me ask you, the president, when he was running for office, said that he would only sign a trade agreement if it had strong labor and environmental protections. And looking at the last three, is that statement accurate? And then looking at this one, do you see anything in this one that would make that statement true?
Well, on the last three, no. There were some, for Colombia free trade agreement, there were some what seems to be cosmetic language changes. There was a plan derived to secure a labor right. However, since the treaty has been signed, Colombia still maintains its record as the most dangerous country in the world for trade unionists, with more being assassinated than any other country. And so I would say in those three, he actually did sign three agreements that did not have strong labor or environmental protections. Now, with TPP, we can't say definitely because
we don't know.
Have not been allowed to see the text. However, from leaks and from statements by the USTR, by the U.S. Trade Representative, nothing would lead us to believe that that this is the kind of 21st century trade agreement that the president campaigned on in 2008.
So what do we do? I mean, at this point, you know, as I understand, this is well down the path towards becoming the law of the land. How do we stop it?
Well, one way, and I think I've said this before, is that the most important issue right now is stopping fast track. That the best way to stop these trade deals is to let the light shine on them, that they're being negotiated in secret, because they know that some of the things that are in these, if they become widely known, folks won't stand for it. And so it's a good thing that just yesterday, over 400 organizations sent a letter to all members of Congress urging replacement of fast track and a new direction for trade. People need to call their congresspeople. They need to call their representatives. They need to call their senators. There's some hope that that things can be a little better this time around. These last elections, a lot of fair trade proponents were elected,
right?
Particularly in the Senate. We have a new, very strong fair trade proponent elected that can help long-standing proponents like Al Franken or Sherrod Brown. But the main thing is to get involved, get educated on the issue, call your Congress people and tell them, we're for trade, we're for balanced trade, but we're not for free trade that destroys our jobs and destroys agriculture and environment around the world.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, it used to be we were trading good jobs for cheap toasters. Sad reality is there aren't even cheap toasters anymore.
But one thing I would say, too, in terms of getting involved, would be to access the Citizens Trade Campaign website. That's the Citizens Trade Campaign, or the Global Trade Watch website. And those two sites have a lot of material to educate yourself on trade and exactly why this kind of thing is happening and how we can stop it.
Yeah, I mean, as I've been saying to folks, the job you may be saving just might be your own.
That's right.
Because, you know, I look at all the jobs we've lost through these trade agreements over the years. Hasn't helped the middle class of this country any. And I look at the massive trade deficits that we've got with countries around the world. And I love to throw out the fact that, you know, the last time as a nation, as a whole, that we had a trade surplus as a whole was 1975. Something seriously wrong with that. You cannot possibly be a superpower given that kind of an imbalance in wealth distribution.
And you know, what's so maddening is that the old saying about the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. And, you know, every time one of these trade agreements comes up, we're told that this is going to be a win-win. It's going to create jobs in our country. It's going to create jobs in their country. It'll just be great. But, you know, right now, just within the 9 months that the Korea Free Trade Agreement has been in effect, and even less, I believe, for Colombia and Panama, according to the racial formula that the Obama administration itself uses, the trade deficit has expanded because of these three free trade agreements, and apparently we've lost 10,000 jobs. 10,000 jobs in 9 months because of three free trade agreements that our Congress and our president voted for and signed.
And this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement is a behemoth. Those were just little tiny. This is the big one.
Because the countries that are involved in it right now, the 11 countries involved right now, but the, like you said, it's a docking agreement where once it's passed, countries will be able to dock onto it.
Yep.
Without any discussion, without any debate in Congress.
That's why we've got to stop it now. That's why I suggest call your congressman, call your senators, call the White House. Say no more. We want transparency. We actually want an agreement that's going to lift people up, not tear us down. Bob Cash, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bob Cash, director of the Texas Fair Trade Coalition. And again, the websites that he said, the Citizens Trade Campaign, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Bob's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete... This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Here's a diabolical idea from the hottest level of hell, down where Wall Street's fiendish schemers and scammers dwell. Conspiring with state lawmakers, such powerhouse banks as J.P. Morgan Chase, U.S. Bank Corp., and Bank of America have devised a new way to enrich themselves by, get ready to gag, ripping off unemployed Americans. As Lily Tomlin has said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. These bankers have slithered into the process that states use to pay monthly jobless benefits to hard-hit people. These payments used to be mailed to recipients or deposited directly into their bank accounts. But Wall Street lobbyists, using phrases like win-win, have enticed states to switch the payment system to bank-issued debit cards. This saves states the cost of mailing or direct depositing the money, but banks don't do anything for free. Someone must pay for distributing the benefits to individuals. Guess who? Yes, the unemployed. Now, each month, the cost of distribution plus a generous profit for the bank are automatically deducted from the meager benefits the jobless receive. Then the bank hits them with ATM fees and other charges for using the card. How handy! In the sense that it puts bankers' hands right into the pockets of unemployed people, forcing those in dire need to pay millions of dollars in unnecessary fees to some of the richest bankers in the land. This is Jim Hightower saying, California, Indiana, Kansas, Maryland, and Nevada don't even allow recipients the choice of direct deposit, forcing them into the clutches of a particular bank, which violates federal law. But the whole system of profiteering on jobless people is an obscene violation of America's fundamental sense of morality. For information and action, go to National Consumer Law Center at nclc.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And you know, it's the sandwich comes at you, touch this, touch this, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Oh, ho, ho, it's magic, you know. Never believe it's not so. It's magic, you know.
Yeah, it's just magic. Don't worry about those people, it's just magic. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And, of course, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. You know, and looking at this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, you know, some of the things that we should be demanding from all of our trade agreements. And this is where, you know, I asked the question about Europe because... You know, this is the first time that we're going to be dealing with a country that actually has higher standards than we have, and considerably. And I point to France more than anything with their 35-hour work week. Not 35 hours and then overtime. 35 hours, that's it. That's what you work. That's it. What's going to happen? Are we going to go in there with this concept of the least restrictive trade barrier and saying, you know what, that 35-hour work week that your citizens cherish and that they live their lives by, that's done. Because we're not going to compete with that. We need you to work 50 hours or 60 hours a week, you know, like the Americans do. So instead of saying, you know, we're going to put a global floor, and I'm all in favor of big trade agreements if they raise standards up. Say, look, there's going to be strong environmental and labor protections. There are going to be 40-hour work weeks. That's it. You're going to have a minimum wage that's equal to, you know, 50% of your average income. So there's some sharing of the wealth. We're going to have environmental laws that are going to have a global oversight. We're going to allow for local procurement so that, you know what, if Pennsylvania wants to build a bridge and, you know, in Allentown where they make concrete and in Pittsburgh where they make steel, we go, duh, we're going to use our own steel and our own concrete. Sorry, it's what's going to happen. And we're not going to be sued in a tribunal. In a secret tribunal. And I go back to this, you know, this whole corporate personhood thing. This elevation of corporations to actually on, not just on equal terms with government, but above having the same constitutional rights as me, as you? Really? Does that make any sense to you? You know, you look at China, and one of the big knocks, and you hear this a lot, that they're manipulating their currency. You know, maybe having some global safeguards. And I've been saying this for a long time. For quite some time, I've been saying we need to have the next Bretton Woods Part 2. We need to have a sit-down where the globe comes to the table and says, you know what? Enough beggar thy neighbor. Enough of this. We're going to extract the riches and we're going to rape and pillage so that the 1% globally gets wealthier and wealthier while workers, well, they fall behind. We need to have that again. And, you know, in years past, I read extensively about the Bretton Woods Accord. And the idea that Keynes had at the time of a global currency, which he called the Bancor. That, and I love the idea because I think it's visionary and it's the right way to go about it. Because it's not punitive and it's not something that punishes so much as it levels. And the idea of this was pretty simple. It was you would have this international currency that everything would be traded in, much like the dollar, because it's what the dollar is, the reserve currency, which gives us enormous power. But we don't use it in the way that Keynes had envisioned. What he had envisioned, he said, okay, well, everybody's going to have, there's going to be a central bank, and all of the trading will go through this central bank, and you'll have, you know, loans, and you'll have the elasticity that countries are going to need when they have trade imbalances to kind of level those out. And countries like China that are producing and producing and producing at wild rates, they're going to be able to continue to produce and produce and produce at wild rates, but they're going to be penalized at the end of it. So if they, for instance, what they have, over a $300 million trade deficit with us, they had a surplus, we had the deficit, what would happen is they would have to pay an amount of money into the bank, which would come to the U.S. to create industry. So as we're losing manufacturing, there would be money coming from the trade surplus back to the U.S. to create some things to help to maintain balance. And beyond that, to continue to have consumers to be able to consume the products that are being produced all around the world. So what you have, and I know a lot of my environmental friends hate the idea because we are a consumer-based globe. Not getting away from that. Sorry, it's just not going to happen. I mean, I love the idea of, hey, let's work 24 hours a week and let's ramp down production. Let's spend more time with our families and reading and cultivating our better natures. Yeah, I'm all in favor of that philosophically. I just don't think it's ever going to happen because, honestly, human beings are a bunch of greedy SOBs. We want more, 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 more. So that worldview, I just don't see possible. So when you start thinking about, okay, well, how could you balance this out? To me, that seems reasonable. Countries that have huge surpluses end up paying countries that have huge deficits. And then you have consumption that both countries are still doing better. But what you don't have is you don't have that global elite to the degree that we have now. And someone sent me an interesting video of you know, how the wealth is being distributed, how we think it's being distributed, and how we would like to see it distributed, which are all three very different things. There's the idea, you know, our ideal situation. There's how it actually is. And then there's what we think it is. So, you know, when you look at the five, you know, the bottom quintile and the top, the five quintiles, the 20% broken down into five sections, you know, that middle class being right there in the middle and, you know, your upper uppers, you know, ideally, you know, perfect socialism was everybody would be equal. That doesn't happen. It's never going to happen. Americans kind of had this view that, you know, you have poor people, but those poor people don't live below the poverty line, and you have a nice sloping upward of wealth going to the very top. And it's a nice, even kind of slope, gradual, gentle. You know, the harder you work, you move ahead a little bit more. That's ideal. What people think it is a little more skewed, but not much. You know, the very few people living in the below poverty, giving them the incentive to work to try and get out of poverty. The middle class doing better and better. And as you get, you know, farther up, you're doing a lot better than everybody else. And it's, you know, the perfect and the perception, no way in reality show what's going on, which is, you know, the working class of this country just getting decimated. When you look at, you know, 1% of the population owning 40% of the wealth of this country, something's seriously wrong. And I forget some of the other numbers they threw out. You know, 90% of the population controlling, I think it was 7% of the nation's wealth. And you go, there is something seriously wrong given that situation. And it comes back down to, you know, what we perceive to be reality, how we think should be, and how they really are. And how they really are is the wealth of this country has been distributed so far upward. The numbers are so far skewed that I don't even know if we want to acknowledge how bad it's gotten. Which is why, for me, these trade agreements should be the place where we demand that things kind of level out. But maybe that's too much to ask for. And I'm really concerned about this one, and I think you should be too. That's why I suggest you call your representatives. Call them early. Call them often. I want to see this stuff on C-SPAN. I don't want this negotiated in the dark. I don't want this in some back room or one of these secretive meetings. Nothing good happens in secret. Anyway, got to take a quick break. When we come back, Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service, will be here to talk about the news of the day. Quick break. Right back.
Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Ask Me Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
It just blows my mind. You know, we're going to cut funding for the TSA. We're going to cut funding for the people screening us. You know, the people who are watching us take our shoes off and take our belts off. But now we can take pocket knives, yay, golf clubs and ski poles and hockey sticks. What in the hell are you doing going on a plane with a hockey stick? And, of course, souvenir baseball bats, you know, just perfect for bashing someone's head in. Yeah, I can't wait. Flying is now going to be a full contact sport. And, you know, after a decade of really boring flying, take your shoes off, take your belt off. No knives. Now we're going to have pocket knives. And if, is it me or did they not do that whole September 11th thing with box cutters, which are smaller than pocket knives? Just a thought. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. Justin, small souvenir baseball bats.
That is certainly interesting. And, you know, I guess the idea behind that is no terrorist could ever love baseball. So as long as it's a souvenir one, that's okay.
There, on American, I get it now. That now it makes perfect sense. And hockey, too, because they don't have hockey in the Middle East.
Exactly. I mean, that's actually what they used to do with the, you know, people they suspected of being foreign agents back in the 50s. They would ask them questions about the World Series. And if they could answer it, then they'd be in pretty good standing.
And that explains it. None of the elitist nonsense with the golf clubs. That's why they're allowed on. Ski poles. They don't really ski in Afghanistan.
I can guarantee, though, that if someone brings on a cricket racket, you know, that's going to be very different because that's big in Pakistan.
You know, it just blows my mind. So my question now becomes, do I still have to take my shoes off? I mean, if I can take a baseball bat with me, do I have to take my shoes off?
I hope not. I mean, that's always the worst part of traveling for me. That's the one thing that I absolutely dread just because, you know, it absolutely slows down everything. But, you know, actually it doesn't bother me as much anymore. Now I started wearing shoes without laces, and I'll fly.
So you got lazy.
Yeah, it makes it much easier.
Yeah, you got lazy. Okay, I get it. I love what the agency spokesperson had to say about it. When they said, you know, about the hockey sticks, lacrosse, billiards, you know, the little baseball bats, souvenir baseball bats, wiffle bats too, because, you know, heaven forbid, we got to have our wiffle ball. He said these are popular items we see regularly. They don't present a risk to transportation security. And I'm going, wait a second. I've got several box cutters.
that blade is like a half an inch. Mm-hmm. The 6-centimeter blade on the knife, isn't that about 2.5 inches?
It sounds about right to me. Yeah.
I mean, just a thought. I mean, if you really wanted to kill somebody with a pocket knife, you could, if you really wanted to.
Well, you know, just to make the point, though, it's kind of doubtful that anybody would really be able to take over a plane with box cutters again.
True.
The only reason they were able to get away with that last time was because nobody really, from what I understood, nobody on the plane thought it was actually going to be a suicide mission.
Yeah, good point.
Up until that point, the idea was, okay, it's a routine hijacking. You hijack a plane using whatever means necessary. Nobody causes any problems. You let the, people hijacking it take it to Cuba or whatnot. And after that, the airline can deal with it. I guess now in this day and age, we're, more knowledgeable about the fact of what they may actually be trying to do. So anything short of, a gun or an explosion or whatnot could probably be subdued pretty quickly.
Cuba, huh? What are you living in the 70s?
I'm just saying, that was the order of the day before 9/11.
That was the 1970s. That was when we should have learned the lesson the first time. By hardening the cockpit door and separating it. But duh. And I guess it goes back to the Churchill quote, Americans always do the right thing after everything else first.
That's a very good point.
So what's going on in D.C.? I see the Senate Intelligence Committee has approved Mr. Brennan to move forward.
Yes, by a 12-3 vote party line. We actually saw at least one Republican side with the Democrats on this, which was Marco Rubio. But it looks like there's still maybe some trouble facing Brennan before he has a full confirmation vote later this week. We are now seeing that Rand Paul, who is, in his mind at least, a 2016 contender, is planning on putting at least some kind of hold on
right.
Brennan or playing some procedural tricks to try to slow this down. The reason for this isn't necessarily that shocking. This is in response to a letter he sent to the Justice Department asking if there was any situation in which the U.S. could legally use a drone against an American citizen on American soil. The Justice Department responded, okay, I guess in some situations, if it was like 9/11 or if it was Pearl Harbor, yes, we would use every means to our, at our disposal. And as a result, he announced this hold.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reality is, Holder came out and said, sure, I could see that happening. It may be, possibly. And I got to be honest, you think about it, you go back to that moment where, September 11th, where there were planes in the air. We didn't know. Do you use it? I mean, it's nice to sit in the armchair and say, never, we shouldn't be using any of that stuff. But it's going to happen.
No, certainly true. And, it would have been a sort of a disingenuous response from Holder if you said that it was something that the administration would never consider.
So what's the fallout from the austerity bomb that went off last Friday? I know we're seeing cuts across all agencies, and I understand the poor children who are going to go to the White House to see the inside. No more tours of the White House.
No, that has been suspended indefinitely. The White House today sent an email to members of Congress saying that they were no longer able to afford the free tours due to sequestration. This is something that's been sort of derided by quite a few Republicans who have ultimately come out saying that this is pure politics and have instead invited, families visiting D.C. to visit the Capitol, which, frankly, I have to say is a much better tour than the White House, which is kind of overrated.
Yeah, I'm with you. But what we should be doing is we should take the right-wing view of this, and we should privatize it. We could have privatized tours. And if you had enough money, if you were willing to pay enough, you could see a little bit extra of the White House, maybe the special servant's bathroom.
Oh, yeah, we could call it the Jose Cuervo White House and have them, sponsor it or something like that. The White House brought to you by Coca-Cola or whatnot.
Now that we've let that out of the bag, the cops are coming for us, right?
This is Capitol Hill. That's how it goes.
I saw the story, and, that would fit right in line with the claims that the Obama, like Clinton and like, so many other, selling access to the White House, maybe the Lincoln bedroom again.
Exactly. We saw Jay Carney come out and say that there's no fixed price in order to see the president, which is not necessarily that comforting of a statement. You would prefer, of course, to hear that the president can't be bought. Correct. That's another point that a lot of Republicans have seized on. It looks like the only people who are going to be seeing the People's House, which is the White House, are going to be the people who are willing to shell out big bucks to catch the president's ear.
And that's the way it should be in conservative world. I mean, that's where we're going, Justin. We're going to where, you know what, you want to do something, you're going to have to pay big money for it. You want fire protection? Better pay your subscription, or if your house catches on fire, we're going to come and roast weenies.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's very true. And, you know, it is interesting to see Republicans balking at the idea of money granting access, considering,
how
this world works.
And I see Hugo Chavez passed away. Should anybody be happy? Should anybody be upset? How's this being taken in D.C.?
It's pretty interesting. A lot of people are viewing this optimistically. We, of course, do not know what's going to happen with the country. But the White House issued a statement saying that their priorities are with the Venezuelan people and hoping that normal relations could reopen with the country. We also saw a number of Republican lawmakers issuing some pretty harsh statements, such as Sic Semper Tyrannis from Sic Semper, I'm bad at Latin, I apologize, as well as others saying that, just sort of celebrating the end of Chavez's reign. Interestingly, we did see a statement from former President Jimmy Carter, who, gave his condolences to the Chavez family and said that he has always believed, apparently, that Chavez has had the interests of his people at heart. That's obviously not as relevant as the President of the United States or whatnot. But, I guess the ultimate consensus we're seeing is, there's a view that, normalization or that relations could be normalized, in the immediate post-Chavez future. But, nobody's necessarily, counting on that quite yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way you normalize relations and the more you get back into good graces, you allow the corporations to come back in and take over. That would be the way to go. If you give back the oil to the big oil companies, give back the all of the things that he nationalized, and corporate America would be very happy and very pleased to extend a hand.
Exactly.
And looking at the big sequester, a lot of funding cuts across the board. I'm seeing a lot of talk today from the Republicans and Senate Democrats that they may come up with a deal. White House not happy with it.
No, they are not. The CR that the Republicans are proposing essentially tries to tweak the automatic sequester cuts while, there's still going to be a cut in spending for the Defense Department. The Republicans have made it so that there's going to be about $10.4 billion more added towards operations to ensure that things can still move forward as expected in Afghanistan. Democrats necessarily haven't been objecting to this, but the main consensus is, hey, what about, basic social services that families rely on to just
buy? Screw them!
That seems to be the attitude of the Republicans. The White House has not said that they would veto the CR proposed by the Republicans. That's going to be going to the House this week. But they have said that they are going to work with Republican leaders to try to tweak it. And we're likely going to see a more humane version of the bill come up in the Senate. And, of course, we are at that situation again where if nothing gets passed, then the entire government's going to shut down again and we are going to all die. So this is sort of a big deal.
Yeah, it's another one of those hostage crisis moments. Well, and again, it's all part of the we want people to throw up their hands and go, screw it, the whole system's broken and they're all crooks, so that they drop out. And to me, that's the end. That's the end goal in this, to turn their stomach to the way they just turn away and say they're all crooks, it's all broken, and let's privatize it all along with the tours of the White House.
Exactly. Interesting to see that this is once again happening. This is, of course, on the horizon, but, there was at least some kind of hope that there would be at least, some time to enjoy the apocalypse that we're already incurring from sequestration before we moved on to the next doomsday scenario.
Well, it's not the apocalypse. It's the death of 1,000 paper cuts. I mean, when this stuff goes, it's all of the cuts, cut after cut after cut.
That's fair enough. I have a more pessimistic view since, I have quite a few, defense people as drinking buddies.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I've been saying that, this is like when I was a kid, the mutual assured destruction, the mad nuclear war between the Soviets and the U.S., where we understood you touch the button and it all goes away. I've been saying the same thing. We continue with this austerity because we've given this ultra-right-wing section of the Republican Party this power to control our economy, and it's this kind of mad scenario. You give us what we want or... it's the end. We're going to hold you hostage, and we will collapse the economy because, well, we believed in scorched earth. The same knuckleheads who back when I was a kid were saying, well, if we push the button first, it wouldn't be so bad.
Exactly. That's just sort of how it goes right now. That is the attitude that a lot of people are having. But, you know, we are seeing more of an appetite going forward for it, especially when it comes to these sequestration cuts. There are quite a few people on the Hill who are openly welcoming it.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I'm not so thrilled with the defense cuts. And I have been in the past saying, you know, we need to cut the Defense Department. But when I see Biden coming out saying Obama's not bluffing on Iran, maybe you might want to rethink those cuts.
Well, it's not just that. You know, you're a union guy. We know that a lot of defense contractors rely on union-made labor for union labor for what they do. And this is something that's going to affect them as well. So, you know, it's really not it's not a rosy scenario to see defense cuts.
Well, no, I'm a firm believer in building things.
Right.
Doesn't necessarily have to be tanks and bombs. Could be roads and bridges. You know, doesn't necessarily have to be a pipeline, but could be something really, really just big, like a dam.
Oh, exactly. That's very true. So, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, of course, you know, this is not something that many people are willing to embrace. Not even a lot of pretty strictly deficit hawks when it comes to defense in the Congress.
Yeah, and finally, the biggest news in D.C., as I understand it right now, Senator Menendez, did he pay for it or did he not?
Well, it's very weird. It looks like there was a report in the Washington Post that really debunked this. There was a prostitute saying that she was, in fact, paid to give false testimony. And following that, we saw the Daily Caller, the weird conservative website that, you know, in full disclosure, I at one point wrote for, saying that, you know, that they, in fact, entered the wrong, or that they interviewed the wrong prostitute and had the wrong person presented.
Yeah.
Right now, the two sides are butting heads. The Washington Post says that they tried to confirm that with the Daily Caller, but they were unresponsive and that their story remains true. And right now, it's just sort of a media gang war going on right now in D.C. over, you know, who's telling the truth. And Menendez at least has to be feeling some kind of relief since now, you know, there is sort of a...
It's off of him.
Doubt, yeah.
Yeah, it's off of him. But, you know, I when I was reading through the story, I could see the Daily Caller going, no, that's not the prostitute we paid. It was the other one we paid.
That's very true. I mean, no one exactly is yet saying that it was the Daily Caller who paid, you know, for that testimony, just to clear that up. But, you know, it is certainly a very strange story.
Yeah,
it looks like they could have been played pretty hard.
Yeah, well, and because, you know, they wanted that story. It was the big one. And like a lot of things nowadays, we don't really check anything anymore. It's just, hey, let's be first. Even if we're wrong, we're first.
Exactly.
It's a strange world. Justin, always great talk with you.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Have you ever stood outside on a dark, starry night and seen a meteor or shooting star?
Sometimes, after a meteor shower, people report hearing the meteors. Some exceptionally bright meteors have been reported as having a low hissing sound, like sizzling bacon.
For years, professional astronomers said meteors don't make a sound. Typically, a meteor burns up about 100 kilometers or 60 miles above Earth's surface. Because sound travels so much more slowly than light does, the rumblings of a large meteor shouldn't be heard for several minutes after you see the meteor streak across the sky. If that happened, a meteor 100 kilometers high would boom about 5 minutes after it appears.
But that doesn't happen. And what about meteors that seem to make a sound at the same time you're seeing them? Astronomers now speak of electrophonic meteors. The explanation is that meteors give off very low-frequency radio waves, which travel at the speed of light. Even though you can't directly hear radio waves, these waves can cause physical objects on the Earth's surface to vibrate. The radio waves cause a sound, which our ears might interpret as the sizzle of a meteor shooting by.
We have more on this subject, plus charts of events in the night sky at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is the clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Fox News alert, it's election day. We got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
He's standing guard. Yes, what's he doing? Well, if you remember the clip, he opened the door for the nice senior citizens as they walked in to vote. Yeah, standing guard, being all menacing looking and well, you heard it in his voice, black. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. At least it was in Los Angeles today. Evidently, there was an argument at a polling place at a Los Angeles elementary school where the polling was taking place, where people were casting their ballot. The election worker was reportedly shot multiple times. The report was maybe it was a girlfriend. The 35-year-old man was working the 92nd Street Elementary School. Argument broke out, took it outside, and bang, bang, bang. Down he went. He is evidently doing well, according to reports. Non-life-threatening wounds. Probably would do all right. But here again, you know, that's... Yay. It's our election system. More fun with guns. So we'll see what happens in Los Angeles. It's either going to be a really good outcome for education as the incumbents get booted out, or going to be a real bad one. Because the people who are the incumbents, the people who are the ones that are being backed by the billionaires, by the Bloombergs and the big money, well, they're the privatizers. They're the ones who are going to take that school district and, well, they're going to suck every last dime out of it. Anyway, tomorrow, if you're in and around town, if you're in Camp Hill, we're going to be out 4230 Trindle Road in Camp Hill at the McDonald's there. There is going to be an action and it's back to this J-1 visa stuff, man. It wasn't bad enough that Hershey was doing it, for getting away with it for who knows how many years, exploiting these kids who come here for a cultural exchange. They pay money to come here so that they can experience American life. They get a job to help cover some of the costs. And then they end up in sweatshop labor conditions. And the story that I've heard, and we're going to hear more tomorrow, and we're going to talk to some folks about this tomorrow after the event, the way it looks is you've got this person who owns the McDonald's, who's, and I've been to it a number of times, and I remember going through going, wow, must be, like a cultural exchange thing going on here. Me not even thinking about it, because every time I go through there, there's somebody new, with a different ethnicity and in a different language, and it was kind of interesting to have little quick conversations with them. Here I find out this is that J-1 program, much like the Hershey thing, where the guy who owns the place is warehousing these people in the basement of properties he owns, packing eight of them into a room, charging them each $300 a head, paying them minimum wage, working them a handful of hours, and basically got them by the short hairs. Here again, the worker is saying, wait a second, these kids from who knows where, saying, no, enough already. We're going to stand up, fight back tomorrow, 11 o'clock, 2330 Trindle Road. We will be there, to be part of it, to see where this goes and to call for action. You know, again, I look at this program and there's part of me that says, they are really getting the American experience. This is a true cultural exchange in that, well, they're being treated like American workers. Working a ton of hours or not working any hours and exploited at especially in the low wage workforce, being the ones who are at the very bottom of the pole. And what that worries me, these kids are going to go back to their countries and they're going to say, that American dream we kept hearing about, that America that we kept idolizing and wanting to emulate, it ain't there. And this is what happened to us. So it's going to be interesting to see, again, 4230 Trindle Road, the McDonald's there. I think it's going to be an interesting day. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you get the podcast. Stitcher. See you back here tomorrow.
to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperialist.